Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here. Tonight on the big program, I'm going to talk with John Hanger, gubernatorial candidate, about his run for the top job. What's important? What are the priorities? What's he seeing going on in Harrisburg now? Good, bad? Thoughts? What could he do better? Also, not surprising, but the Republican response to the catastrophe in West Virginia? I'm not surprised by it. You shouldn't be surprised by it. It is what we expect, but I got to be honest. It's no less shocking that you take the position, we don't need any of those stinking regulations. Regulators couldn't have stopped it. Yeah. Also, looks like Congress has actually done their job, and a budget on the federal level may be possible. I guess 3 days. We got a three-day budget, but there's a possibility of something a little longer. We'll take a look at what we know at this point and maybe what we should be talking about and how we get the budget actually to create jobs. Just a thought. Also, is it the end of the Internet? Well, a ruling in D.C. today may facilitate that end, as it's the end of net neutrality and the beginning of pay for play. If you can pay to be the preferred content, you're going to get the faster content, which means programs like this will suffer, which means an alternative voice to the corporate special interests will die. And that's the point. Also going to talk about the attacks on workers that have found their way here to Pennsylvania. How are workers going to respond? How are you going to respond? That really is the question. I say to the streets, but we shall soon see. Also going to take your calls, your questions, your comments, what's on your mind this evening. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. You can also email me during the program at rick@thericksmithshow.com. Go to our Facebook page, The Rick Smith Show. I also do the whole Twitter thing and all that as well. The big news of the day for me, that the Senate blocked the unemployment extension. And I guess, you know, it's what's infuriating on so many levels. The people who sit in the halls of Congress, and a little bit later on in the program we'll talk to someone from the Center for Responsive Politics, about the Millionaires Club now, because now for the first time, the average wealth of our 535 members of Congress has now exceeded $1 million. So the Millionaires Club filibustering, and the Senate especially, filibustering meager extensions of emergency unemployment benefits just seems cruel to me. And especially when you put it into the context that the world's 300 richest people added $524 billion to their collective fortunes last year. 16.4% raise they got. 16.4% increase in their wealth. And I go back and I continue to ask the question, when are we going to wake up and demand a portion of the wealth that workers create? Because you go and you look at the studies that have been done, and they are out there. In 2009, 93% of all new income gains went to the top 1%. 2009, 2010, and into 2011, 121% of all new income gains went to the top 1%. And you hear people screaming, oh, you're talking about redistribution of wealth. Well, what do you think that was? What do you think falling wages, destruction of benefits, destruction of working conditions, destruction of environmental laws, all of the things that we're seeing right before us, all of the failures of our policy, of our government right before us, all brought to us by one ideology? And it is the conservative, what has taken over the conservative ideology. Understand, you know, probably 30, 40 years ago, there are a lot of things I would have agreed with conservatives on. You pay your bills. You're responsible for yourself and your family. There are a lot of things. You protect institutions. I'm with you on some of this stuff. But the current conservative movement is really fixated on consolidation of wealth, control, consolidation of power. More for them, less for you. It's that simple. And any workaday person who would say, I'm a conservative, needs to have their heads examined. You know, I had a guy recently tell me that he wasn't a conservative like that. He was just conservative in his thinking. And I said, well, what exactly does that mean? Now, granted, he couldn't explain it, but there was part of me that said, maybe it's just you don't want to think, so you're conserving what little thinking you actually do. Because when you look at the facts, you look at what's right in front of us, you look at the 2x4 that just smacked us across the back of the head, we're on the losing end of all of this bad policy. So when you look at the Millionaires Club, who pushes for deregulation, who pushes for lower corporate taxes and lower taxes on the very well-to-do, and free trade agreements that can ship jobs overseas, you got to ask yourself, folks, what's going on? What is this country going to look like in 5, 10 years? What country do my kids inherit from me? What opportunities do they have left? Because what we're doing is we're creating a poverty-ridden nation. We're putting ourselves in desperation's way. All for the benefit of the handfuls. You know, I found it quite ironic that today, while the Senate Republicans were filibustering the extension of unemployment benefits, you had John Boehner running around saying, well, we don't need any stinking regulations, and pointing at Obama saying, we need to be looking at job growth, and it's Obama's fault that we don't have job growth. Now, understand, there are many things Obama should have been doing, and I'll be the first to point out his shortcomings. The idea of stimulus, the idea of creating jobs by having investments in our country, not one of the things I blame him for. He said, look, we should be investing in alternative energy. Republicans have blocked and destroyed that. You look here on the state level. They have destroyed the solar industry in this state by not extending and changing and fixing the SREC credit system. A couple of years ago, one of the solar energy renewable credits went for $250 a credit. It's down to like $10 now. The industry's done. Done. All those workers, out of work. Gone. Goodbye. The president said, we want to invest in high-speed rail, in public transportation. Every step of the way, what have they done? They put massive roadblocks in the way and denied the money. Those things right there created jobs. You got Walker in Wisconsin. You got all these governors saying, well, we're not doing that high-speed rail thing. It's going to create jobs. We don't want that. It might make that black guy in the White House look good. Can't have that. Because understand, this is about the Republican obsession with one guy. They're willing to scorch the earth of this country for one guy. And they said it on day one. You go back to the beginning of Obama's administration, you had Mitch McConnell saying, you know, well, we're going to make him a one-term president. You got the titular head of the Republican Party, Rush Limbaugh, saying, well, I hope he fails. Full well understanding that his failure meant the failure of the country. And that's what's infuriating to me. I don't really remember, and I know it didn't come from my mouth, ever wanting Bush to fail. I knew his policies were bad. I knew his ideology was horrible. I knew it was going to lead to nothing but more debt and destruction. But never once did I ever say, I hope he fails. And you look at the misadventures he got us into. But I look at this. The opportunities that have been lost. Because you have a Republican Party that's hell-bent on no. Hell-bent on their ideology is jobs will be created only when taxes are so low that we can starve the government and drown it in the bathtub, that there are no regulations, that we have open border free trade. You go down the list of all of these bad ideas. And we've done it Corporate taxes, historically low. Taxes on the very wealthy, historically low. You look at the actual rate that corporations pay, historically extraordinarily low. They're sitting on piles of cash, sitting on trillions of dollars. The wealth class, our global wealth class, well, like the Bloomberg Billionaire Index, the top 300 people in the world had an increase of over 16% of their wealth, $524 billion they added to their coffers. And you go, well, what did they do with that $524 billion? What did they do with all this wealth? You look at Wall Street and corporate America. What are they doing with this wealth? Are they investing here? Are they building factories? Because they're getting tax breaks. We're giving them basically what they want. They've got us in a hostage situation. We're going here. Take it. Go ahead. But do something. Think of the billions and billions of dollars we give out in economic development money that really, honestly, ain't working. And it comes back down to some very, very common sense things. And I don't remember who it was, but I'll never forget the guy on TV saying, look, you give me a $20,000 tax cut, I'm going to Bermuda. You send somebody walking through my business's front door, I got a customer, I'm going to hire someone to meet that demand. But you give me a tax break, I'm going to Bermuda. You give me more money, I'm going to put more in my pocket, more for me, and the heck with everybody else. And it's very, very curious to me that while the Republicans are just getting creamed on the war on poverty message, because, you know, they've got this whole war on poverty, and they're getting creamed at every turn because, one, they have no policy, they have no initiatives, they have no ideas other than the same things that have been failing for years. But they have rhetoric. And what I'm saying is today, when they had a chance to say that they really cared about the poor, we really care about them, just to extend unemployment benefits or offer a jobs plan, they didn't either. And I asked my Republican friends, you know, get back involved in your party. Bring them back to some sanity. Get rid of the extremists. Because, you know, contrary to popular belief, unemployed workers, they're Republicans too. And maybe the party should remember that. Anyway, I got to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with John Hanger, former Secretary of the Department of Environmental Protection here in Pennsylvania, running for the top job here in the state, one of the gubernatorial candidates on the Democratic side. Quick break, right back. Stick around. We want the world and we want it now.
Just right. The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
Labor rights are civil rights. 46 years ago in Memphis, Tennessee, Dr. Martin Luther King advocated for workers' rights, equity, and justice. 50 years ago in Mississippi, progressive people issued a call. Progress in Mississippi depends on you, they said. The result of that call is what we know today as Freedom Summer. High on the agenda of the Mississippi Summer Project were the rights of workers.
Civil rights organizer and Mississippi Alliance for Fairness at Nissan member Frank Figures. Infused with the spirit and principles of the civil rights movement, Nissan workers at the Detroit Auto Show on Monday launched a new campaign in their drive to unionize the Nissan plant in Canton, Mississippi. It's called Tell Nissan. Labor rights are civil rights, evoking the powerful grassroots movement that transformed the South. Chip Wells has worked for Nissan in Mississippi for nearly 11 years. He says when he was hired in, management told him they didn't want a union, what they called a third party, getting between Nissan and its workers. But experience has taught Wells that workers in Mississippi need that union.
Well, I'm telling you now, after 11 years, almost 11 years, we need that third party, that organization that we would lead, not that someone else would lead us, the workers in Mississippi at Nissan plant, to sit down at the table with our managers and the company to decide what's best for us and not them telling us what's best for us without our input.
Workers trying to organize with the United Auto Workers say there are a host of serious issues at the Nissan plant, including erratic, unpredictable work schedules and safety issues, and how injured workers are treated by Nissan.
Ergonomics. The same jobs that employees do repetitively lead to injuries. And then after a year, if you have that same injury and you can't report back to work, you're administratively terminated. And that is wrong. There's got to be a voice for the employee at the Canton, Mississippi plant.
Rafael Martinez is also a Nissan worker who supports joining the UAW. He says labor rights are civil rights at the Canton, Mississippi Nissan plant.
Labor rights are civil rights. So really, how are we affected by that? Well, we are affected in a number of ways. One of the ways that we are affected is that the company itself, they're trying to intimidate the workers not to have a union. The message that they're sending out there, that they're promoting, that all a union will do is shut the company down or move the company. That's not true.
Martinez says successful Nissan plants around the world have been union for years, and Mississippi workers just want the same labor and civil rights.
Workers Independent News is brought to you with support from union-owned and represented Bank of Labor, member FDIC, equal opportunity lender. The Bank of Labor is the bank of choice for unions and their members. Now you can do business with a bank that shares labor values. More info online at bankoflabor.com.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
I am so pleased to be your governor, and I ask you to give me your support as I run for governor again, because I am running for governor of Pennsylvania.
Yeah, I like the inflection in his voice. Like, he's actually surprised that he's running for governor, especially with the approval ratings that we have seen. I've seen numbers between 24 and 36%, which, I got to be honest, a sitting governor, not so good going into re-election. But you look at the priorities that this guy has pursued over the last 3 years, and I would argue that they're not the priorities of average, everyday working people in this Commonwealth. The assaults on education, the assault on health and human services, the assault on health care, all down the list. You look at the priorities of giving huge handouts to big corporations. You look at the drilling up in the Marcellus Shale fields. Not the right priority in my mind. So this November, there's going to be a choice. And before that, of course, the primaries, which there's a bunch of Democrats running, which is why we've asked John Hanger, the former Secretary of the Department of Environmental Protection during the Rendell years, also a candidate for the Democratic side of the gubernatorial ticket, to come talk to us. John, thanks for taking time for us.
My pleasure.
You know, I look at this, and to me, the main issue. There are a number of issues, but education, to me, is one of the hills that the working class of this country has to die on. And over the last 3 years, this governor has gutted investment in the future, gutted investment in our public education system. Some 20,000 education professionals out of work. Wrong priority, in my view.
Absolutely. And let's be clear about what's really going on. This governor and the people around him want to privatize not just the liquor stores and the lottery, but they also really want to privatize public education from kindergarten all the way through higher education. In order to do that, they have to weaken public schools. And the best way to weaken public schools is take money away from them. That's why we've seen this vicious assault. And, of course, it's one of the reasons why Pennsylvania's economy and our job creation under Governor Corbett has collapsed. And I'm going to reverse those cuts. We're going to put money into schools, not jails. We're going to put money into jobs, not jails. We're going to stop chasing down people for possessing small amounts of marijuana. We're going to let doctors prescribe cannabis to sick patients. We're going to have a new birth of freedom in Pennsylvania. But we're going to get back to the basics of investing in education and creating good-paying jobs.
Yeah, I saw recently you put out a position paper on higher education, the fact that our students, our college students, are coming out of universities and out of colleges, not just here in Pennsylvania but across the country, saddled with massive amounts of debt. What's your plan?
Right. Pennsylvania's students have the third highest amount of student loan debt. It's crushing dreams. It's crushing students from working families in particular, even going to college. So I'm going to throw open the doors of our community colleges by my college affordability plan. It would allow every Pennsylvanian to go to 2 years of community college or 1 year of our state public universities without taking on student loan debt. We create a fund, capitalize it with $1.5 billion of bond money. That fund pays the tuition, and then students pay back into the fund when they become workers. They pay 1 to 2% of their income once they are workers over a 15-year period, and the fund will become self-supporting.
It sounds like an interesting plan. I've seen others kind of along the same idea. But do you think 1 year to a university, do you think that's enough?
Well, that's why the basis of the plan is 2 years of community college. You can get 2 years of community college or 1 year of state university. We want to expand this college affordability plan over time, but we've got to start right now. We've got an inequality crisis here in Pennsylvania and the United States. We need strong, bold programs and measures to create real opportunity for so many working families.
You know, you've mentioned when they become workers, and you know, there's a time right now we're. You know, back in 2011 when we were in Wisconsin, sleeping on the marble floor of the Wisconsin Capitol, saying the attacks that were going on back in 2011 in Wisconsin were going to come to Pennsylvania. And it looks like they're coming here, and they're here now. And, you know, I see a lot of politicians, going after workers' rights, especially the Republicans, especially the governor. And at a time when this is going on, you're one of the few people that's actually made a central theme of your campaign to stand with workers, and I point to the Philadelphia cab drivers. I haven't heard any politician say anything about these low-wage, hard-working people. Why is this issue important to you?
Well, I came to this country in 1970 off a plane from Ireland, went right into the public schools, and I carried a union card for 8 years in my early days, including 4 years when I was a legal services attorney in the city of Philadelphia. I know what it means to work for a living. I know what it means to have a union that represents you and negotiates a good living wage. And unfortunately, so many people across Pennsylvania now and across the United States have no bargaining power at work. And that's why the pay is unfair. What the CEOs and the top executives are doing very, very well. Corporate profits have never been higher in the United States than they are right now. The economic pie keeps on growing, but the slices going to the working families and to the middle class are stagnating or falling. Men are earning 19% less than they were 30 years ago. 19% less.
Wow.
We have to face up to the income inequality. And because of my life, because I wasn't born with a silver spoon in my mouth, and because I was a legal services attorney, and because I paid for my legal education by taking on a lot of student debt, over $30,000 in the early 1980s, I understand what it means to have a good-paying job and a union, and I understand what it means when you don't have a good-paying job and union representation. So I stand with workers, and I stand with unions.
So when you look at these attacks that are going on there, there are a number of the paycheck destruction stuff that's going on right now, this push towards no rights at work, what they call right to work, basically for free. This not something that would be acceptable during your tenure as governor.
That would be dead on arrival. It would be vetoed were it to get through the General Assembly. That's not going to happen. I think it's time for Democrats in particular to talk bluntly about income inequality and workers' rights. And I think it's time for Democrats to absolutely stand with unions. Democrats are pretty good at taking union support during elections, but then they kind of go mute during the period of governing. We have to rebuild unions in the United States if working families are going to have a fair shake in the workplace. I support raising the minimum wage. That's important. I support education and education opportunity. That's also important to attacking income inequality. But workers are going to help themselves. And the way they can do that is by organizing and negotiating a living wage at the workplace. Government actually can't do that. Workers are going to have to do that. And Democrats, the party of the working people, need to support unions. So you will hear from me when I'm governor the phrase, join a union. Because joining a union is the way to make this country fairer, to make this economy work better for all families and not just the very rich.
I'm right there with you. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show here with John Hanger, former Secretary of the Department of Environmental Protection during the Rendell years. He's running for governor. Website, hangerforgovernor.com. We've got a link at therickSmithShow.com. Just click on John's name. It'll take you right there. You know, I look at, you know, last week there was the 50th anniversary of LBJ's speech on the war on poverty in the beginning to try and alleviate poverty and inequality. Also, you know, it was the anniversary of FDR's For Freedom speech. You know, I'm right there with you. I think the Democratic Party needs to get back to those roots and talk about income inequality, talk about poverty and making people's lives better instead of what I think we've seen for the last several years of being just less bad.
Right. You know, look, we've got a Republican Party, and it does a darn good job representing its members and the very rich. We need a real Democratic Party. We need a progressive party. I'm from the Elizabeth Warren, Bill de Blasio wing of the Democratic Party. I'm a true progressive. You can see it at hangerforgovernor.com. I'm a smart, tough progressive, and I don't mind stepping on the elite. So that's what we need to do. We need to recognize that the last 30 years of trickle-down economics has just made this country's economy unfair to working people. And that's now reached a point where it's just about everybody is getting the short end of the stick, with the exception of literally the top 1%.
And it's not even just the top 1%. It's that fraction at the top of the 1%, because there's even stratification there.
You're absolutely right.
Which I find even more scary when you have someone like the Koch brothers, because I'm told that the Koch brothers were here in Pennsylvania over the Christmas holiday, promising Republicans, we'll double whatever working people give you if you just give us this paycheck destruction, if you just give us this no rights at work stuff that we've been getting all around the country. And I got to be honest, we need people, voices like yours, who are going to stand up and say, this ain't the way to go.
Right, and I think the pendulum is swinging, but there is a bit of a race going on. We've got the corporate administration that is wounded and has got hopefully less than 11 months left in office, and it might be entering its most dangerous period right now because it is wounded.
And that's what scares me, because all this ugliness we've now seen just pop up, and I keep saying it's the purification process of the Republican Party. They're now basically, I think, conceding the governor's race and just going to purify the rest of the party.
Well, it's possible. It's possible. We're going to have to be vigilant, and Democrats have to return to those roots, and Democrats have to recognize that working people are getting the short end of the stick in the workplace, because only 7% of working people now in the private sector are members of union. And the boss is getting a lot of money, but everybody else in the workplace is not doing well.
And we're seeing that. Let me ask you this question, because, you know, the last couple of days we've been focused on what's going on in West Virginia. And, you know, as former Secretary of the Department of Environmental Protection, you know, I look at what's going on there in West Virginia and I go, you know, the lessons that are playing out there, possibly, you know, at some point we could see these kind of things happening here. And you see the John Boehners of the world and the Republicans saying, we don't need any more regulations, and it's the fault of the president for not inspecting those places. You know, as the former head guy of the DEP here, you know, looking at that, where did things go wrong? What would we be doing differently in Pennsylvania to protect the citizens of our state? I'm curious your thoughts.
Sure. Well, just a little bit more on my bio. I also worked with Governor Casey as a commissioner of the Pennsylvania Public Utility Commission. So I've led two state agencies. Both of them are regulating agencies. I'm an expert on energy. And what happened in West Virginia, of course, was a chemical spill This was a chemical that was used to clean coal. It was a company that had not been inspected since 1991. And you can't make this up, but a Republican legislator, hours before the spill, was attacking the governor of West Virginia for, quote-unquote, regulating us to death. It's totally ludicrous. When it comes to human safety, worker safety, you must, in fact, inspect, and you must have tight, strong rules and that work. Look, this is common sense. Folks who are being watched work better and safer. Companies that are being watched care more carefully about what they're doing. It's sort of like how we all drive on the highway. When the state police is on the road, I and my fellow motorists drive better. I'll admit to it right now. And it's the same thing when it comes to worker safety and the environment. We need the environmental cops on the beat. These attacks from the Tea Party Republicans about we're overregulated, most of the time it's baloney. So occasionally there are some stupid regulations, and we ought to fix those. But most of the time the problem is in the opposite direction, as we've just seen in West Virginia. We have unregulated businesses doing dangerous things.
And to highlight what you said about the legislator there in West Virginia, on the federal level, the House of Representatives on that Thursday passed the Reducing Excessive Deadline Obligation Act, which went and redid a bunch of the language in the Superfund law and some of the other reporting laws for solid waste and all of that stuff. It's one of those coincidences. Well, while they're bashing regulations, here they have exposed 300,000 people and, you know, millions more in this country, in my
opinion. Right. Well, I served as the Pennsylvania chair of the Coal Mine Safety Board here, and I'm very proud of the fact that in 2010, it was the first year in the history of the state, of the Commonwealth, when no miner died on the job. Every other year, up until 2010, we had at least one death, and often, unfortunately, tragically, many more than one death through our history in the coal mine. And what has allowed Pennsylvania to move to a period of no deaths in the mines was strong state and federal regulations, real inspection, cooperation between the United Mine Workers and some of the bigger, more responsible coal companies that operate here. We know how to have safe mines. We know how to have safe water, and strong regulation with real inspection is right at the heart of how you do that.
I'm with you. I got an email just a second ago from Leonard who asked about your position. You had mentioned about cannabis and medical marijuana. He wants to know, how far are you willing to go? Are you willing to go the Colorado route where we're legalizing marijuana? Your thoughts?
I am. We have my whole cannabis reform or marijuana reform plan is at hangerforgovernor.com. It includes legalizing and taxing marijuana. We are wasting $350 million a year arresting about 25,000 people for possession and ruining their lives. We could tax it and raise up to $200 million a year. It's time for common sense to be brought to this question. And what we've been doing for the last 40 years has been a total disaster for taxpayers. It's ruined many lives. It's harmed others. And now we need to go in a different direction where we regulate and tax and use the money for the many pressing things that we've already talked about here, including education.
You know, what's interesting is we've talked about a lot of issues that I think many people in this Commonwealth are focused on and want our government to focus on, yet all I keep hearing coming out of the Corbett administration is, attacks on workers, attacks on the public sector, fire-saling our assets, the lottery, the liquor stores, not much in the way of allowing money to flee the Commonwealth through the Delaware loophole and all of the gerrymandering and all of these things that the average everyday person doesn't want. We want good, safe roads. We want safe neighborhoods. We want good schools for our kids. We want opportunity and that, yet I'm not seeing it coming out of Harrisburg right now.
No, absolutely not, and you won't with this governor. Very frankly, he's a terrible fit for the job. Even the Republicans who support him and are going to vote for him privately will tell you he's a terrible fit for the job. He's got a lousy jobs record. In the last year of the Rendell administration, the state created a net new 87,000 jobs. We were creating 80 to 90,000 jobs at the end of the Rendell administration each and every year. Had that continued, we would have created, by this point, over 270,000 jobs. This governor has barely created half of that. Pennsylvania has created just one-fourth of the jobs that have been created in New York in the last 12 months without drilling one shale well. This governor has one economic development plan. It's called Drill Baby Drill, and it will never bring broad prosperity to all of Pennsylvania. Drilling will create jobs for perhaps 2% of Pennsylvanians. The other 98% are going to have to come from healthcare, education, transportation, agriculture. And this governor is clueless about our economy. Oh. Now, I've spent 29 years working on our economy, working at the Public Utility Commission and at the Department of Environmental Protection, working on clean energy and wind and solar. I know how to create jobs, and we've got a jobs plan at the website, hangerforgovernor.com, that would create 382,000 jobs.
And we'll make sure we get a link at the RickSmithShow.com. Real quick, couple of quick bang-bang things. Medicaid expansion, if you're governor, you take it?
Absolutely. Yes.
On the fracking side, are we for it, against it? Are we for, you know, regulating? And what's your position?
I wrote the moratorium on gas drilling on the state forest. That was me, John Hanger, wrote the moratorium on drilling in the state forest. I support a moratorium on public lands. On private lands, people's farmland, it must be strongly regulated. Local communities must be allowed to zone strongly, and it must be taxed. We ought to be raising $800 million a year that could be invested in public education.
Delaware loophole?
Closed.
The high-speed rail, public transportation?
Well, I'd love it. We're going to need, obviously, major federal support for high-speed rail. We can do much more for our public transit systems that already exist here in Pennsylvania.
Good stuff. Last thing, my pet peeve. The Republicans have destroyed the solar industry in the Commonwealth. I've got solar panels on my house. When I bought them, the SREX were at $250 a credit. Now they're down to about 10 bucks because they have screwed this whole system up and destroyed an entire industry. What do you do to fix that?
Well, you're talking to the father of the Pennsylvania solar industry. I passed the SREX. I passed the PA Sunshine Program and administered the PA Sunshine Program.
Thank you for that, by the way.
Yeah, and I'm very proud of the 7,000 solar systems that were created through that good work. So we're going to double the portfolio standard, including the solar requirement. We're going to refund the PA Sunshine Program. We're going to have 10 times as many solar systems built in the first 8 years or the next 8 years as a result of those policies, at least 10 times as many. And we're going to put as many as 10,000 Pennsylvanians to work in the solar industry.
Good, all music to my ears. Great stuff on the website, hangerforgovernor.com. We've got a link at therickSmithShow.com. John Hanger, great talk with you. Appreciate the time. Please come back and talk to us again.
I'd love to do so. You do a great job. Keep fighting for workers.
Thanks so
Thank
much,
you.
John. Quick break. Right back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Oh, 90% of the wealth, where do you fit in? Take a look at yourself. 10% of the people own 90% of the wealth.
Where smart policy and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
This is the Media Matters Minute. I'm Coleman Lowndes. Fox's senior political analyst Britt Hume defended Chris Christie's political vendettas in the wake of the ongoing bridge scandal on Fox News' media buzz. When asked about Christie's emerging bully narrative by host Howard Kurtz, Hume deflects blame from Christie onto today's, quote, feminized atmosphere.
So what about this bully narrative?
Well, I would have to say that in this sort of feminized atmosphere in which we exist today, guys who were masculine and muscular like that in their private conduct, and kind of old-fashioned tough guys, run some risks.
Later, on the O'Reilly Factor, Hume kept digging, saying that politicians being labeled racist or sexist is an unfortunate side effect of the civil rights and women's rights movements.
One of the worst things that can ever be said about you, politically fatal if it sticks, is that you're a racist. It is also the case that if you're accused of being a sexist, and that can be made to stick, that's also very damaging. Yeah. So in some respects, these triumphs have the side effect of placing a cudgel in the hands of people who are willing to use them, and at times unscrupulously.
For more on this and other stories, please visit MediaMatters.
Can antibiotic medicines, long hailed as miracle drugs, be too much of a good thing? Yes. Two factors are at work here. First, bacteria, one of the earliest forms of life on Earth, are miracles in their own right, with a stunning ability to outsmart the antibiotic drugs through rapid evolution. Second, is the rather dull inclination of us supposedly superior humans to overuse and misuse antibiotic medicines. Every time we take an antibiotic to kill some bad bacteria that is infecting our bodies, a few of the infectious germs are naturally resistant to the drug. So they survive, multiply, and become a colony of superbugs that antibiotics can't touch. Multiply this colony by the jillions of doses prescribed for everything from deadly staph infections to the common cold, and we get the, quote, antibiotic paradox. The more we use them, the less effective they become, for they're creating a spreading epidemic of immune superbugs. A big cause of this is the push by drug companies to get patients and doctors to reach for antibiotics as a cure-all. For example, millions of doses a year are prescribed for children and adults who have common colds, flu, sore throats, etc. Nearly all of these infections are caused by viruses, which cannot be cured with antibiotics. Taking an antibiotic for a cold is as useless as taking a heart drug for heartburn. The antibiotics will do nothing for your cold, but it will help establish drug-resistant superbugs in your body. That's not a smart trade-off. This is Jim Hightower saying, in fact, it's incomprehensibly stupid. Antibiotics are invaluable medicines we need for serious life-threatening illnesses, but squandering them on sore throats has already brought us to the brink of superbugs that are resistant to everything. That's the nightmare of all nightmares.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Thank you. The National Labor Relations Act was a New Deal initiative which helped save American capitalism by creating a process which would protect the rights of employees and employers. This was before NAFTA, GATT, and the WTO, which tore legal rights for workers apart, moved millions of jobs out of the U.S. Yes, we stand for the workers at Boeing in Washington State, but we also stand for the workers at Boeing in South Carolina. Because they will have no recourse if Boeing wants to move jobs to China. You can't say you want to create jobs here at home while destroying the rights of workers to organize, the right to collective bargaining. These are basic rights in a democratic society. You can't say you want to protect American jobs and not protect American workers. Take away workers' rights to free speech, take away workers' rights to due process, and you create a new class of slave laborers here in the United States who are helpless to stop the movement of jobs out of America. Hey!
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. You know, again, you know, hangerforgovernor.com, the website. I like what I heard. You know, to be honest, it's nice, it's refreshing, it's about time we hear Democrats saying, you know what, we're going to stand up for working people. We're going to stand up for people having rights. And, oh, by the way, we're going to help create jobs by encouraging industry. I mean, the guy who as he said, you know, the grandfather of the solar industry here in the Commonwealth. And thankfully to him, you know, I got the solar panels on my house. But here we got a governor and a Republican legislature doing everything they can do to destroy that. And that's what's infuriating. You take these steps forward where you're moving towards progress, you're moving towards becoming a better state. And then you've got these laws, man, where they just want to take you back to the dark age. That really is what we're seeing. We're seeing a party that wants to take us back to the Stone Age. Or at least back to the good old days of the 80s and 90s. the 1880s and 1890s. This idea that we can't regulate, this idea that we can't control what goes on in our state. And I look at this John Boehner quote. He had a news conference, and you know, he was asked about the spill in West Virginia. And blame the president. I mean, because the president's to fault for everything. Boehner said the issue is this. We have enough regulations on the books. What the administration ought to be doing is actually doing their jobs. Why wasn't this plant inspected since 1991? I would argue the exact same reason that the fertilizer plant in West Texas had not been inspected since 1985. The fact of the matter is you've got very lax state regulations. The fact of the matter is you've got industry people in bed with the regulators. And you go back to the Mineral Management Service, with the explosion in the Gulf, if you remember that, the Horizon, the Deepwater Horizon explosion. Literally, they were in bed together. That's just not a figure of speech. It was literal. And the swinging door between industry executives and the regulators back and forth. Something seriously wrong there. Boehner goes on to say, I'm entirely confident that there are ample regulations already on the books to protect the health and safety of the American people. Somebody ought to be accountable here. And I got to be honest, I agree, somebody ought to be accountable. The CEOs of the company, somebody's got to go to jail. Problem is, nobody ever does. We've allowed this company to make 300,000 people's lives miserable for a week. And, well, we don't need no stinking regulations, and nobody's going to go to jail. That's the thing that gets me. You go back to the explosion in West Texas, where I think it was 15 people died. Nobody went to jail. And, you know, you go back to this whole thing of, you know, if I ever wanted to kill somebody, I think you just hire them, right? Since nobody ever seems to go to jail. And, you know, I've asked a number of people who are intimate with these things, when was the last time we locked anybody up because one of their employees died on the job due to really just negligence? And I've yet to get an answer of it ever happening. So the chances of anybody being held to account of this are nil. I'm not even going to say slim. Just it's not going to happen. Tiny fine, bankruptcy, and then they just change their names from Freedom Industries to Patriot Industries. Because that's what we do in this country. It's a sad thing. And the reason I think what's going on in West Virginia is important, and the reason why we need to have strong regulatory oversight is, you know, how many spills are going on right now in the Commonwealth that we don't know about? Because I think, as John Hanger pointed out, you know, fine, you're going to do it on private land, but it's got to be done with strong oversight. And I know there are those who say, but Rick, it's their private land. They should be able to do whatever they want. It's their land. Yeah, it's true on a certain level. But, you know, I go back to Supreme Court Justice Black, who said you have the right to swing your fist around all you want until it touches the tip of my nose. And you have the right to do on your land what you want to do until it affects me, it affects your neighbors, it affects the health and welfare and the well-being of the Commonwealth and its citizens. You know, I love the libertarian arguments because, you know, they're simple. But when your rights infringe on my rights, we got problems. So it'll be, I'm interested in the next couple of months as the primary season heats up, because I think there are like 8 or 12 Democrats that are running against each other, and all of them, virtually all of them have good points, some of them have bad points, so it'll be interesting to see how this all fleshes out, and here on the program over the next couple of weeks, we're going to try and get all of them to come on and talk to us at one point or another so that you can make an informed, educated choice on who to support and who to get behind. I like a number of the candidates. And as we move forward, we'll flesh some of that out. I'm going to take a quick break. When we come back, a little bit about the budget, some good stuff in there, some bad stuff, a little bit about the post office as well. Right back after this.
bright blue in an ocean of red. Rick Smith.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
On July 5th, 1935, the National Labor Relations Act was signed into law. It is also known as the Wagner Act after its chief sponsor, New York Senator Robert Wagner. Prior to its passage, Senator Wagner chaired the National Labor Board, created by Franklin Roosevelt in 1933 to attempt to bring order to labor-management relations. The National Labor Board consisted of three representatives from labor and three from industry, with Wagner as the chairman. It was here that Senator Wagner realized government assistance was required to level the playing field if labor unions were to effectively bargain with management. President Roosevelt said of the National Labor Relations Act, "It should serve as an important step toward the achievement of just and peaceful labor relations in industry." Hailed as the Magna Carta of labor, once the National Labor Relations Act was signed into law, workers were encouraged and protected to exercise their newly recognized rights to freedom of association, self-organization, and engage in concerted activities for the purpose of collectively bargaining through a representative of their own choosing in order to establish wages, hours, and conditions. Employer interference, such as threats and intimidation, firing, refusing to negotiate with the union, and discrimination for union activity were expressly prohibited. These illegal activities are described as unfair labor practices by the law. The impact of the Wagner Act on American life was substantial. The standard of living for American workers, their families, and communities was extraordinary. Unionization rates increased to a high of 35% of the American workforce as American workers demanded their rights. Working men and women finally had a unified voice to stand up and fight for dignity, respect, and safety in their workplace. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Where smart policy and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. So the on the federal level, it looks like they're ironing out some of the details of their $1.1 trillion budget plan. That's going to, I guess, fund our government until the end of, I guess, it's October or something around there. So, you know, it's several months. Hey, this is better than the three-day one we got today. But, you know, there's a talk of maybe a little lengthy period. Maybe we'll see some the beginnings of some common ground as we realize that people are really ticked off at what Congress has not accomplished over the last couple of years. Now, there've been some good points to it, some things, not so sure. But one of the things that caught my eye is that under this budget plan, they're going to continue 6-day postal delivery. In fact, they gave a 2-year increase in the cost of a first class stamp, you may remember, from 46 to 49 cents. That'll go into effect on January 26th. And will not, should not, but they're saying will not last more than 2 years. Just to kind of help them get their feet back under them. Now, me, I would have said, hey, let's undo the poison pill of the Bush years that made them pre-fund their retirement health care 75 years into the future. Maybe that would be a start. Because if you look at the numbers, they would have made a very small profit had that onerous regulation, had that poison pill piece of legislation but not put into place. You know, it's always interesting. You know, I love to hear the Republicans say how, well, owners, job-killing regulations. But you look at the post office, the job-killing law that they passed. Never hear them talk about that, do you? Anyway, six-day delivery will continue for the next couple of years, the next year, I guess. Now, the Postal Service has been wanting to gut that. And you got to wonder who's running the Postal Service and who and what business experience they have. Because when you start constricting your business, when you start limiting the number of things that you're doing well, it's got to hurt you, I would think. Just a thought. Interesting bit of thought on the budget, though. You look at the Head Start program. Head Start got some more money than it would have gotten under Scrooquester. And I guess all of it. Everything was a bit forward. You go down the list, Head Start, Meals on Wheels, scientific research under the National Institutes of Health, food safety. Everything got a little bit more than it would have under Scrooquester. For those of you who don't know, the sequester that had automatic across-the-board cuts that the Supreme Court, that Chief Justice Roberts said, we just can't possibly continue with the now remember, Republicans said these were just mild cuts. Anyone could do away with 2 or 5%. Just because there's so much waste, fraud, and abuse and fat in these budgets, right? But Roberts is saying, no, I can't afford to run the judicial system on what little money we're getting. But you'll go down the list, heating assistance, rental assistance, right down the list of all of the things and all of the programs that our government helps people with. A little bit more money than they would have gotten under the sequester. Less money than they would have gotten otherwise. People are saying it's a compromise. You found middle ground. Well, you're going to have to learn to tighten the belts. Well, you know what? Belts are being tightened already. We're at a time when need is at a high. Not an all-time high, but still at a high. Now, what I haven't seen and what I'm still looking for is that jobs plan. Where's that investment in our future? Where's the money to be? Because, look, I, this is what blows my mind. We could basically borrow money for free. And if you could take that and put it into productive use, where you're generating economic activity, I have to think that's better than saying, well, we're just going to let people languish. At least that's my thought on it. And, with today being the day that the Republicans in the Senate filibustered the unemployment extension, don't you think a jobs plan would have been somewhere where we'd go and say, all right, well, if we're going to take this away, take it with one hand, give it with the other, something? And what it brings me back to is they're not afraid of us in the streets anymore. They're not afraid of their heads on platters. Figuratively, not literally. Quick break, right back with Hour 2. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Smith Show, changing America for the better.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
Labor rights are civil rights. 46 years ago in Memphis, Tennessee, Dr. Martin Luther King advocated for workers' rights, equity, and justice. 50 years ago in Mississippi, progressive people issued a call. Progress in Mississippi depends on you, they said. The result of that call is what we know today as Freedom Summer. high on the agenda of the Mississippi Summer Project were the rights of workers.
Civil rights organizer and Mississippi Alliance for Fairness at Nissan member Frank Figures. Infused with the spirit and principles of the civil rights movement, Nissan workers at the Detroit Auto Show on Monday launched a new campaign in their drive to unionize the Nissan plant in Canton, Mississippi. It's called Tell Nissan, Labor Rights or Civil Rights, evoking the powerful grassroots movement that transformed the South. Chip Wells has worked for Nissan in Mississippi for nearly 11 years. He says when he was hired in, management told him they didn't want a union, what they called a third party, getting between Nissan and its workers. But experience has taught Wells that workers in Mississippi need that union.
Well, I'm telling you now, after 11 years, almost 11 years, we need that third party, that organization that we would lead, not that someone else would lead, us, the workers in Mississippi at Nissan plant, to sit down at the table with our managers and the company to decide what's best for us and not them telling us what's best for us without our input.
Workers trying to organize with the United Auto Workers say there are a host of serious issues at the Nissan plant, including erratic, unpredictable work schedules and safety issues and how injured workers are treated by Nissan.
Ergonomics. The same jobs that employees do repetitively lead to injuries. And then after a year, if you have that same injury and you can't report back to work, you're administratively terminated. And that is wrong. There's got to be a voice for the employee at the Canton, Mississippi plant.
Rafael Martinez is also a Nissan worker who supports joining the UAW. He says labor rights are civil rights at the Canton, Mississippi Nissan plant.
Labor rights are civil rights. So really, how are we affected by that? Well, we are affected in a number of ways. One of the ways that we are affected is that the company itself, they try to intimidate the workers not to have a union. The message that they're sending out there, that they're promoting, that all a union would do is shut the company down or move the company. That's not true.
Martinez says successful Nissan plants around the world have been union for years, and Mississippi workers just want the same labor and civil rights.
Workers Independent News is brought to you with support from union-owned and represented Bank of Labor, member FDIC, equal opportunity lender. The Bank of Labor is the bank of choice for unions and their members. Now you can do business with a bank that shares labor values. More info online at bankoflabor.com.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Volkswagen just invested in Tennessee in a right-to-work state at a low cost with less health care. Why should we prop others up when other companies can compete in this marketplace? It's time to let these people learn the lesson the hard way.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. So the very first piece of legislation that the Missouri House Committee on House Workplace Development and Workplace Safety Committee, very first thing that they took up, very first, their first priority was to go after workers and their unions, pushing this no rights at work agenda. It is the top agenda piece of the Republican House Speaker there in Missouri, a guy named Tim Jones from Eureka, his very, very top priority. And you got to wonder why. Missouri, now we're hearing the whispers in Pennsylvania. I see that a guy named Justin Everett, a Republican from Colorado, Jefferson County, Colorado, introduced a piece of legislation banning collective bargaining between public employees and the public employer. Now, understand, in Colorado, like Pennsylvania, you're not required to join the union. You don't have to engage in bargaining, but it's not illegal either. What this piece of legislation would do is it would make it illegal. It is illegal. And any contract that is in place the day that this passes is terminated. So much for the belief in contracts. And I've been saying, 2011, we were in Wisconsin saying, hey, it's all coming this way. And if you remember 2011, Wisconsin severely restricted public sector bargaining. Tennessee completely outlawed it, made it illegal. Ohio, if you remember, they did the same thing, only it got overturned in referendum. 2012, Michigan, in a lame duck term-limited session, passed the No Rights at Work agenda. And now here we are, kind of in the same position that we saw in Michigan. There's the gerrymandered districts going on, some people coming, some people going. The purification by the Koch brothers, a lot of money coming in here. It's going to be interesting to see how things go here in the next several months, which is why we've asked our good friend Abe Amoros, legislative director here in Pennsylvania for the Laborers International Union of North America, LIUNA, to come talk to us. Abe, thanks for taking time for me.
You're welcome, Rick. Thanks for having me.
So you look at this wave, and I remember laying on the floor of the Capitol in Wisconsin, freezing my behind off, going, folks, the reason we're here, get ready. This is coming our way. Now, granted, that was 3 years ago, but here we are.
That's exactly right, Rick. I remember having that conversation with you that we had to be careful because these well-funded individuals, such as the Koch brothers, they've got billions to put into these crazy movements. And, of course, they have a receptive legislature because there were two pieces of identical legislation, House Bill 1507 and Senate Bill 1034, that would make payroll deductions for dues, fair share fees, political contributions, all that stuff would be non-negotiable in public employee collective bargaining agreements. So here we go again. Anti-worker legislation in Republican-controlled legislatures. And, the lobbying efforts have started, man.
Yeah, here's
we
the
have
thing.
Got
here.
To visit these people and tell them this is unacceptable. You're either with us or you're against us. Yeah, nobody gets a pass, Rick.
I'm with you. But here's the thing. You know, I've had a couple of conversations since we've been focusing heavily on this issue for some time now. I've had a number of conversations with listeners on this, and they look at me with glazed over eyes. It's viewed as this is it's a technical union thing. But as soon as you start saying, look, this is an assault from outsiders. This is an assault from Wall Street. This is an assault from the Koch brothers. These are the people who are trying to interject their values, their views, their wants here in our state.
That's exactly right. It's union busting. That's what it is. It's an assault on working people. And it's the first step to making Pennsylvania a right-to-work state and completely weakening unions throughout the Commonwealth and the Northeast, for that matter, because you think they're going to stop in Pennsylvania if they're successful? Oh, hell no, they're going to keep going, and they're going to keep going. I mean, this is what happens when the far right has way too much money and way too much time on its hands. And I understand that there was a conversation with the Corbyn administration also. So now he's pushing for it. This was after he said, if right-to-work legislation reaches my desk, I'll sign it, but you'll have yourselves to blame for it. I mean, he was taking a passive approach, Rick. Now he's taking an aggressive approach, which everybody should remember when they go to the polls this fall. I mean, this is a guy who caves easily.
Yeah.
Easily.
So let me ask you. I mean, you're someone who spends a lot of time talking to politicians on both sides of the aisle. Was there before Christmas, was there really an appetite in the legislature for this kind of divisive politic? I mean, there's so many other things that still need to get done. Was there an appetite before Christmas? Because I understand the Koch brothers representative, or they came to town promising huge, huge caches of cash if they got their wish. So I'm curious, pre-Christmas, pre-Koch brother visit, was there an appetite for this?
No, not at all, Rick. These things slipped under the radar screen very quietly, and when people saw what they were trying to do, they said, oh, no, these are harmless bills. They're innocuous. Don't worry about it. Not a problem whatsoever. And then that representative, and I was told that it was one of the Koch brothers himself who came to Pennsylvania and basically said to some of the members in leadership and the governor, listen, whatever you get from labor, we'll double it. We'll double it. So they're basically buying them off. Now, fortunately, the state Senate caucused on this briefly. I emphasized briefly yesterday, Rick, because there's really no appetite with the leaders on it. I know that the majority leader, Dominic Pileggi, basically poo-pooed the idea because it came up. It came up in discussions by rank-and-file members, and I know that they were smacked down pretty quickly on it. So, I mean, that's a good sign. But nonetheless, we have to remain extraordinarily vigilant. We're going to be making visits into the district offices and getting in their faces and saying, you can't be against us on this. I mean, there will be consequences if you vote yes on this bill. We need you to vote no. Nobody gets a pass. We're talking about a visit to every single member of the state legislature, Democrat and Republican. I mean, I sat in a meeting this morning sitting next to the Democratic leader in the House, who said that he's got 92 votes. Well, we're going to go see every single member and make sure that it's 92 votes before we take that to the bank. That's how critical this is. I mean, we've got to keep everybody, even our friends, who might get mad at us, but, you know, we got to do it.
Yeah,
we may get thrown out of an office or two, but we got to do it. We got to know who's with us, who's against us, and make it public.
Yeah, I mean, this is a huge issue, but yeah. And let's talk a little bit about it because it is kind of technical.
Yeah.
And but, you know, the premise behind it, I mean, this is honestly what it is. This is one of the ALEC model legislation bills, right?
Mm-hmm.
One of the American Legislative Exchange Council's pieces of prepared legislation
right.
on their wish list for all the entire country.
That's exactly right.
So in looking at this, because, you know, well, you know, how hard is it to, because I hear that it's onerously expensive to collect the dues. That's the reason that the ALEC people give. That's the reason I've heard some legislators say that we have to have this 1507. It's the money. It's the taxpayers' money, and that they're being stewards of the dollar and being fiscally responsible. How expensive is this? And how much would the taxpayers save? And is there any guarantee the taxpayers will save any money?
Absolutely not. That's all rhetoric. It's just fear tactics and confusing people and making them afraid of something that doesn't exist. It's like saying there's a monster under your bed. When you look under your bed, it may be a little dark, but there's no monster down there. And what these guys are doing is they're hoodwinking the public and taking advantage of an anti-union sentiment that sadly already exists and blowing it out of proportion. Hey, this isn't going to save a dime of taxpayer dollars. The paperwork is already simple. I mean, there's absolutely no reason to even go there in terms of tax savings or any improvements to the taxpayer. I mean, that's all nonsense. It's all garbage. So what they're doing is they're messaging, and our message has to be, listen, if they get away with this, people will not be contributing, and the unions are going to disappear, and working issues are going to fall off the table. And before you know it, you know, 9/10 of the legislature is going to be bought and paid for by corporate America. Is that what you really want? Because that's not what we need right now.
Well, that's what the Koch brothers want. That's why they're willing to double your money. That's why they're willing to fill the coffers short term.
That's right, and they're scaring people, Rick. Let me tell you, our normally solid, labor-friendly Republicans from the Southeast, some of them are balking. I mean, they don't like those bullseyes on their backs. They don't want to be primaried. And these guys want to take advantage of the fact that there are only 7 legislative days before February the 5th. Now, the petitions are going to be circulated on the 18th. So they're trying to smoke out those who would vote no and primary them. I mean, two of our friends have already gotten 6 and 9 mailers already in their districts, saying, oh, these guys are rhinos, Republicans in name only. I mean, they're not worth your time and effort. And so it's just because they have been labor-friendly in the past and really looked out for working families in their districts. And, you know, it's frustrating because they've got the cash to turn our lights out if we let them.
Yeah.
That's why we've got to be vigilant. That's why we've got to have people on the street. That's why we've got to have these legislative visits and the right kind of messaging as well that really connects to the average person on the street that doesn't understand those technical nuances that you do.
Now, I understand on Tuesday, January 28th at 10 a.m., there is a press conference
yes.
That a number of labor groups are having in the Capitol Rotunda. That's Tuesday, January 28th, 10 a.m. What's the message going to be there?
The message is going to be that working people cannot possibly tolerate these gambits that these Republicans are putting out there, because when you weaken a union on political purposes, by the way, because of course unions predominantly support Democrats. I mean, that's obvious, just like the chamber predominantly supports Republicans. What we need to do is we need to have as many people that can attend that day come to the Capitol so it goes from a press conference to a rally. That's what I'd like to see, simply because we need more voices and we need them amplified. So then the message is the working people are not going to stand by and let these guys lie to the public and saying these are innocuous bills. They're going to save taxpayer dollars. The unions are the bad guys. Absolutely not. We are the defenders of the middle class, and that's what we need to keep hammering away at these individuals, because they're getting away with it. And they're trying to get away with something that's completely horrible. And working people really need to wake up on this one, because this is the scariest. These are the scariest bills I've seen in a long time, Rick. I mean, we've talked about a lot of things on your program. I mean, we've talked about prevailing wage. We talked about pensions. We talked about privatization. But, brother, if we go down this slippery slope, we're going to be in big, big trouble. And those in Michigan thought, oh, it can't happen here in Michigan. Those in Wisconsin said the same thing as did our friends in Ohio and Indiana. Hey, if it can happen in those states, it can certainly happen here, because these guys have enough cash to turn our lights out. So that day, we need to be vigilant. We need to be vocal and say, no, not in Pennsylvania, not on our watch.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. And again, it's 10 a.m., Capitol Rotunda, on Tuesday, January 28th. I know I'll be there. I'm sure you'll be there.
Yes.
I hope everyone comes out for this. But in looking at this, you know, you got to answer the question of, you know, for you know, someone who may never be a member of a labor union, for someone who doesn't see the direct benefits. And I've talked to a number of people who have told me, oh, there's nothing in it for me. And then you go through and you go, oh, I see now. This is how it benefits you. Yes. But for someone who doesn't think that it's going to help them or hurt them or anything, what's the message to them?
The message to them is, look, unions make sure that you have a decent, livable wage with health care benefits that allow you to maintain a family and take care of a family. That's what unions do. And union wages help other wages as well, because they have to have this little thing called competition for good workers. I mean, it benefits economies, local economies, county economies, regional economies, statewide economies. Being a part of a union and having those good family-sustaining wages benefits every citizen in Pennsylvania, and also promotes safety procedures, also promotes training, also makes sure that the best qualified and the best experienced workers are doing these heavy jobs. And I'm talking about construction now. I mean, unions are good all the way around, and we need to keep saying that. And somewhere along the line, Rick, the word union became dirty, and we haven't fought back hard enough. And let me tell you, I'm willing to die on that hill fighting back and saying, you guys are full of it. You guys are full of it. You need to stop, and here's why you're wrong. And I hope that we can start doing that on the 28th.
I'm with you. Last thing I've got to ask you, though. The people who are pushing this, these are the folks who, without exception, tell me that they believe in smaller, less intrusive government. Get government out of my life. Get government off my back.
Right.
Yet this is going to make sitting down at a bargaining table and negotiating over this item illegal.
That's right.
Putting government squarely in your life, how does that square? I'm struggling with that.
It's not, Rick. It's total hypocrisy. What they're trying to do is they're trying to smoke out the real reason why they're doing this. It has absolutely nothing to do with efficiency. It has absolutely nothing to do with saving taxpayer dollars. It has everything to do with squashing unions, hurting working people, and letting the corporations take over so they could pay people $10 an hour on heavy construction jobs with no health care benefits. That's exactly what they want to do. They want to protect their corporate interests because they know they have deep pockets, and they know that they're willing to write those big checks when it comes time for election. We have a very cowardly state legislature in terms of the House Republicans, with the exception of about 12 to 15 labor-friendly Republicans. I mean, these guys won't stick their necks out for working people, and it's frustrating because, you know, they all come from working-class families themselves, but somewhere along the line, they decided that government and assistance from the government is dirty. It's filthy, and it shouldn't be done. So what do? They try to starve it. They try to make you afraid of it instead of seeing all the positive things that it has contributed to our society. But we can't let them get away with it, Rick.
I'm with you. So the bottom line in this is, first, it's political payback, mm-hmm. and it's profit over people,
oh,
bottom
sure.
line.
Sure. Absolutely. You hit the nail on the head. Yep.
Abe, I look forward to seeing you on the 28th.
Yes,
I'm hoping to see a bunch of our listeners out there as well. Again, 10 a.m. on Tuesday, January 28th, Capitol Rotunda. Abe, thanks so much. Appreciate the time.
You're welcome, Rick. Thank you.
Quick break. Right back. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
exposing that free trade is never free. The Rick Smith Show.
Tales of American Political History with Clinton Porter Hackney.
We've begun the story of the establishment of our Pledge of Allegiance to the American flag, which occurred in 1892. Youth's Companion magazine had begun a crusade to put an American flag in every school in the nation to hopefully develop a stronger sense of unity needed to heal remaining wounds from the Civil War. Additionally, they'd come up with the idea of a Pledge of Allegiance. The magazine's owner, Daniel Ford, asked Francis Bellamy to write a pledge. Bellamy was a Baptist minister and a Christian socialist, but he was also a talented writer and author. Bellamy wrote a very brief pledge and Ford approved. Ford and his marketer, James Upham, planned a huge rollout of their magazines, flags, and the pledge at schools everywhere in conjunction with the 400th anniversary of Christopher Columbus's discovery of America. Join us again to see how well it worked. This is Clinton Porter Hackney at cphackney.com.
Can antibiotic medicines, long hailed as miracle drugs, be too much of a good thing? Yes. Two factors are at work here. First, bacteria, one of the earliest forms of life on Earth, are miracles in their own right, with a stunning ability to outsmart the antibiotic drugs through rapid evolution. Second, is the rather dull inclination of us supposedly superior humans to overuse and misuse antibiotic medicines. Every time we take an antibiotic to kill some bad bacteria that is infecting our bodies, a few of the infectious germs are naturally resistant to the drug, so they survive, multiply, and become a colony of superbugs that antibiotics can't touch. Multiply this colony by the jillions of doses prescribed for everything from deadly staph infections to the common cold, and we get the, quote, antibiotic paradox. The more we use them, the less effective they become, for they're creating a spreading epidemic of immune superbugs. A big cause of this is the push by drug companies to get patients and doctors to reach for antibiotics as a cure-all. For example, millions of doses a year are prescribed for children and adults who have common colds, flu, sore throats, etc. Nearly all of these infections are caused by viruses, which cannot, repeat, cannot be cured with antibiotics. Taking an antibiotic for a cold is as useless as taking a heart drug for heartburn. The antibiotics will do nothing for your cold, but it will help establish drug-resistant superbugs in your body. That's not a smart trade-off. This is Jim Hightower saying, in fact, it's incomprehensibly stupid. Antibiotics are invaluable medicines we need for serious life-threatening illnesses, but squandering them on sore throats has already brought us to the brink of superbugs that are resistant to everything. That's the nightmare of all nightmares.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Oh, one lie leads to another, two lies covers the other three lies. Now you're in an awful fix. Four lies, you're getting in deeper. Five lies, piling up steeper. Get wise, or you're going to be telling six.
So it was today back in 1993 that President Clinton issued new confined space standards that prevented somewhere in the neighborhood of 50 deaths per year and 5,000 injuries to workers across the country who entered confined spaces. And you go and you think about this, very common sense regulations saying, hey, we want to protect workers. I don't know in this day and age if that's possible. I don't know if having that kind of regulation wouldn't be met with John Boehner saying, we don't need no stinking regulations. I mean, it just blows my mind that on this spill in West Virginia, you've got Boehner out in front of this pointing the finger at Obama, saying it's his fault. He should have gone and inspected. Even though you look at budget after budget after budget after budget for the last 30 years, where they've squeezed and squeezed and squeezed what regulatory oversight we've got, and add to that the swinging door of the leadership from the industry back to the government to the industry back and forth, and you got to go, there's a certain ideology here that's at play. Now, I look at this spill in West Virginia, which has a very interesting timeline. And I, you know, as I was reading through it, a fairly interesting timeline. The Department of Environmental Protection in West Virginia was alerted to the problem. Said, you know, people called and said, hey, we smell this. It smells like licorice. Come out and look at it. And they were there, and to their credit, quickly. In fact, they got to the Freedom Industries storage facility about 11.05 a.m. on Thursday morning. Now, which is interesting because Freedom Industries didn't report the spill until noon. So they're on site before Freedom Industries even knows that there's a spill and reports it. So they reported at noon. The general public isn't told anything until around 6 o'clock. And you got to kind of wonder, you know, how long was this spill going on? Did anyone know? And a couple of newspaper reporters and a couple of reports have gone and talked to people. Heaven forbid we do investigative reporting. And found that some of the residents locally, you know, around the river said, yeah, you know, around Christmas time smelled it. You know, one of the guys said, you know, my kids took a shower one day back before Christmas and, you know, it was just itching uncontrollably, which they never do. And you go back and you kind of look at this stuff and you go, how long's it been going on? Now, they questioned one guy, one of the residents, his name is James Vermillion. And he says, you know, hey, you know, having these strange smells wafting by your house isn't uncommon when you live in Chemical Valley. Because these kind of releases and this kind of stuff happen all the time. Just most of the time, it's small enough that it's never reported, and, you know, it goes away, and you get used to it. And so you get, you know, maybe you end up with a large growth on the side of your head. Eh, it happens. And the question, you know, becomes, you know, how often does this stuff happen that it doesn't get reported? How often does this kind of stuff happen where nobody notices and the companies just, oh, just don't say anything? Think about this for a second. 16% of the entire state of West Virginia's potable water was contaminated by this one little spill. 7,500 gallons is not an enormous amount. When I was going to school in Ohio, there was a toluene spill, hundreds of thousands of gallons. That's a major spill in my view. It's bad. Anytime you release hazardous chemicals into the water, into the atmosphere, bad. But the fact that this place hadn't been inspected since 1991, you go back to what I talked about earlier about the plant in West Texas, the fertilizer plant hadn't been inspected since 1985. And you've got to start asking these questions. Even if you're just residents in a neighborhood where they're, hey, there's a facility that I don't even know what they do. Now you got me thinking, hey, has anybody been in there to inspect? What are they doing? What kind of, and this is the problem with this deregulation stance, because now you're going to, at some point, the populace turns. At some point, people go, whoa, wait a minute. Nothing's safe because nobody's paying attention. And I got to be honest, for my business-friendly folks, that's bad for business. It's horrible for business. But here what we've got is we've got a political structure that all we care about is the here and now. And the question that I'll leave with on this, what will West Virginia do? Will they say that storage facilities have to be inspected? Because oddly enough, they're not. Will they do something to move forward? Now, every story that I've read, there's not much hope. There's a number of politicians saying, hey, we need to close the loopholes that this company was able to exploit. We need to strengthen regulations. And maybe those calls will continue for a day or two or a week or a month. Question is, does it turn into anything that actually protects we the people? We shall see. Let's take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Uncovering the con
in conservatism. Rick Smith.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
Labor rights are civil rights. 46 years ago in Memphis, Tennessee, Dr. Martin Luther King advocated for workers' rights, equity, and justice. 50 years ago in Mississippi, progressive people issued a call. Progress in Mississippi depends on you, they said. The result of that call is what we know today as Freedom Summer. High on the agenda of the Mississippi Summer Project were the rights of workers.
Civil rights organizer and Mississippi Alliance for Fairness at Nissan member Frank Figures. Infused with the spirit and principles of the civil rights movement, Nissan workers at the Detroit Auto Show on Monday launched a new campaign in their drive to unionize the Nissan plant in Canton, Mississippi. It's called Tell Nissan, Labor Rights Are Civil Rights, evoking the powerful grassroots movement that transformed the South. Chip Wells has worked for Nissan in Mississippi for nearly 11 years. He says when he was hired in, management told him they didn't want a union, what they called a third party, getting between Nissan and its workers. But experience has taught Wells that workers in Mississippi need that union.
Well, I'm telling you now, after 11 years, almost 11 years, we need that third party, that organization that we would lead, not that someone else would lead, us, the workers in Mississippi at Nissan plant, to sit down at the table with our managers and the company to decide what's best for us and not them telling us what's best for us without our input.
Workers trying to organize with the United Auto Workers say there are a host of serious issues at the Nissan plant, including erratic, unpredictable work schedules and safety issues and how injured workers are treated by Nissan.
Ergonomics. The same jobs that employees do repetitively lead to injuries. And then after a year, if you have that same injury and you can't report back to work, you're administratively terminated. And that is wrong. There's got to be a voice for the employee at the Canton, Mississippi plant.
Rafael Martinez is also a Nissan worker who supports joining the UAW. He says labor rights are civil rights at the Canton, Mississippi Nissan plant.
Labor rights are civil rights. So really, how are we affected by that? Well, we are affected in a number of ways. One of the ways that we affected that, the company itself, they're trying to intimidate the workers not to have a union. The message that they're sending out there, that they're promoting, that all a union would do is shut the company down or move the company. That's not true.
Martinez says successful Nissan plants around the world have been union for years, and Mississippi workers just want the same labor and civil rights.
Workers Independent News is brought to you with support from union-owned and represented Bank of Labor, member FDIC, equal opportunity lender. The Bank of Labor is the bank of choice for unions and their members. Now you can do business with a bank that shares labor values. More info online at bankoflabor.com.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Bringing sanity and rational thought back to America. Rick Smith.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. According to a report put out by the Center for Responsive Politics, the median net worth for our members, our current members of Congress, as of the May filing deadline, exceeded the $1 million mark for the first time. Things are rosy, really extremely rosy for our elite lawmakers, got to be honest. And from their pitch, from where they sit, I got to wonder. How minor things like extending unemployment benefits, making sure a single mother gets food stamps to put food on the table, workers struggling to make ends meet, get out of the poverty wage known as the minimum wage. It's no wonder that doesn't list really high on their list of priorities. But here to talk about their report, I've asked Vivica Novak. She's the editorial and communications director over at the Center for Responsive Politics. Their website, opensecrets.org. Vivica, thanks for taking time for us.
Greetings.
I look at this report, and I've got to be honest, it doesn't surprise me that we've got a millionaires club making laws when you look at the laws that benefit the very well-to-do and, well, not the rest of us.
Well, there is certainly a disparity between the median net worth of members of Congress and U.S. households more broadly, which is for U.S. households in 2012, the median net worth was $69,000 as opposed to $1 million.
So we're in completely different worlds. So who was the richest individual, who was the richest member of Congress this past year?
Well, that would be Daryl Issa, the California Republican, and he has been on top for quite a while. Last year he was deposed by Michael McCaul, a lawmaker from Texas, Republican lawmaker. But this year, Daryl Issa is back on top, and he has an average net worth of about $464 million.
Wow. So minimum wage not high on his list of priorities. And party-wise, which party of our two-party system, which one seemed to pocket the most money?
Well, maybe surprisingly, the Democrats are slightly wealthier on the whole than Republicans. Although the if you break it down, House and Senate, Democrats and Republicans, it's Senate Republicans who are the wealthiest group by far.
Yeah, I was going to ask, you know, who's wealthier, senators or House members? And I probably, just without knowing the numbers, say the House members are probably the poorer of the folks.
Yeah.
Because they're supposed to be closer to we the people by design.
That's right. It's almost like the Senate is our own House of Lords. The median net worth for all senators was $2.7 million in 2012, as opposed to a little less than $900,000 for House members.
So you look at that and you go, you know, how is it, you know, any Joe lunchbox or Joe six pack or, you know, Jane 9 to 5, how are any of us in the working class ever going to get into that club and actually affect real change that I think would benefit all of us?
Well, that's you know, you don't have to have money to run for Congress, but it sure helps. And it, you know, actually having personal wealth as a candidate helps quite a lot. And a number of candidates do put their own money into their races.
Yeah, I mean, do you know who the poorest member of Congress was?
Yeah, he's also a California Republican. I'm looking for his name here. I think it's Valdao, who is a dairy farmer. And I'm not sure that, you know, certainly on paper he's the poorest, because his family farm has a lot of loans. Whether he's actually the poorest in terms of living hand to mouth, the paper value may be deceptive there.
Now, I know Joe Walsh used to be the guy who, because he actually had a negative net worth, especially when you took child support into
mm-hmm.
account. But, you know, he found his way out the door. Rather quickly. So, you know, in looking at this, you know, I gotta ask the question, you know, historically, you know, the people holding these offices, they have been in a more elevated socioeconomic class. How does this class compare, to past Congresses? You know, are we talking much more wealth? Where are we?
Well, it's inching up every year. You know, the median net worth here is slightly higher than it was the year before, and higher enough that it tipped things over so that more than half of members of Congress have an average net worth of $1 million or more. But it's been incremental every year, and we're finally getting to that point. Now, you know, to be fair, it costs a lot of money to run for Congress, and also $1 million isn't what $1 million was in 1970 or you know, decades ago. But it is still a far different picture than you see with the average U.S. household.
Yeah, I don't know that I know very many people in that stratosphere, especially that run around in my circles. But, you know, one of the questions I've always wondered about, Vivica, is, you know, you have these people who have enormous wealth, who sit and make decisions that at some point have to benefit them or negatively impact them. And you got to wonder, you know, who manages their wealth while they're in Congress? Because those moments of conflict have to come up, and things have to come in front of them where there are numerous special interests that come to them where they could benefit. How is that handled?
Well, you know, many members of Congress set up blind trusts or, you know, have holdings, most of their holdings in mutual funds so that they don't necessarily know at any given moment what stocks they have. But that's not to say that, you know, members of Congress have not at times taken advantage of, you know, situations to benefit themselves.
To line their pockets.
Yeah, and that's been, you know, there have been cases of that over the years. But it's also true that despite the fact that this is public information and we at the Center for Responsive Politics, which is open secrets www.thewriterslist.org. That's our website. But we put out this analysis every year. And, you know, despite the fact that there is transparency here to a great degree, the voters keep electing people who are wealthy. So I don't know what that says either.
So I guess that... I guess the next question I had is, do you think most people care? Do they realize the wealth, the great wealth that they have, or do you think they even care?
I don't know. You know, as a research group, we put this information out there because we believe in transparency and we believe voters should have as much information as possible, and then do with it what they will. But it is interesting, as our executive director says, you know, people say they're dissatisfied with Congress overall, more and more so, actually, but they still keep electing affluent politicians to represent their concerns in Washington.
Well, I mean, could that be the old adage, you know, Congress stinks, but my guy's okay?
Right. That's certainly probably part of it.
Because, you know, they see the bacon coming home to their district, or they see, you know, firsthand what their guy's done. So I guess it's easy to point outward and say, oh, everyone else is horrible, but we love our guy.
Well, it's always, you know, when you know someone or you get to know someone, it's more likely that you're going to be sympathetic to them, or you're going to like them, or, you know, you're going to be able to overlook some of the criticisms.
Yeah, you know, but here's the thing that gets me is, you know, when you see folks in this socioeconomic strata where, you know, you start seeing the policies, the ideology, the push towards lower taxes, because it seems to be universal. We need to have low taxes. We need to have free trade agreements that ship jobs overseas. We need to, you know, a lot of the things that this business-friendly mentality, it doesn't surprise me, looking at the numbers that you've put forth, that there's some common ground on those issues because, well, you know, that's where the food's at, I guess.
Yeah, I think that we've got an amazing response to this this release that we put out, this analysis. And, you know, it's funny because, as I said, it goes up incrementally every year, but, you know, the median being $1 million or more for more than half of them is seems to be kind of a tipping point. And there's great interest in the analysis, but I wonder if it will have any impact when it comes time to vote in the 2014 midterm.
Yeah, and I'm hoping. I'm always hopeful, but I look at all of the money that's in politics, and like, as you've said, if you have money of your own, it's a lot more helpful to put some of your own money into the campaign. But I look at the Koch brothers, who evidently are coming here to Pennsylvania to spend a whole boatload of money on pushing the right-wing agenda that has been sweeping across the country. Some $400 million. The Koch brother network spent in the 2012 election. And at some point, don't we have to ask the question that, you know, all of this money is toxic to our democratic process and to our government?
Well, we don't express a view on that, but we do put out information that people can use to make their arguments either way. It is very, very expensive to run for office, and members of Congress are told, you know, there was a Democratic retreat a few years ago where Democratic members were told they have to spend 4 or 5 hours every single day fundraising in order to raise what they need for their next race.
Yeah, I've had a number of friends who have served in Congress who have said that was the part of the job they just despised. Because, you know, day one, you're begging for money for 2 years down the road, especially House members.
Right. Right. And, you know, the minute you get into Congress, if you have any kind of debt left over from your previous campaign, even before you're sworn in, you can have a debt retirement fundraiser, and it just starts right away all over again.
So I look at this image that you have on your website of the maze of money that the Koch brothers have kind of put around. And, you know, we hear a lot of these names of these, you know, the Center for This or That for Protecting Patients' Rights and Americans for Prosperity and Americans for Dogs and Puppies and, you know, all of all of this money that just constantly berating us with these messages that I think are destructive for middle class families and for the working poor of this country. Is there any push to open up where this money's coming from? I know you guys have done a great job of looking at the Koch brothers, but there's so much of this wealth class money that's really just completely secretive that I don't think we'll ever know where it went.
Yeah, these tax-exempt nonprofits are what you're talking about, groups like Americans for Prosperity and a number of others that spend money in elections without really having to disclose where it's coming from. And this is a whole sector of funds, of money in politics that is unlike any other, any other money, because all other money under campaign finance laws, you have to disclose where it's coming from. Candidates have to report where they're getting their donations. PACs have to report where they're getting their donations. But these nonprofits don't, because of this section of the tax code that governs their structure. And it's a real problem. As I said, the one thing we do advocate for is transparency. And this is an increasing part of our political dialogue that is not transparent at all. And the IRS has actually proposed rules that would help at least stem this tide. And I think that comments are due on these proposed rules in February, and we'll be commenting, and a number of other groups are already commenting. But at least there is some interest and some recognition that something perhaps needs to be done here.
There has to be. And if you want to take a look at the graph, the infograph, opensecrets.org, it's right there. It's an amazing kind of little figure of where the money goes, and this whole intertwining of this whole schematic of where this money just goes everywhere. And it's mind-boggling that that you were able to track this down. But the sad thing is how absolutely accurate is it? And I would probably argue that the numbers that you probably put into it are even low, are even lower than what you've got.
Well, you know, I think what we've been able to find is accurate, but there's a whole bunch of money we haven't been able to find. Yeah. We haven't been able to track down where it's coming from.
Again, the website, opensecrets.org. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Vivica Novak's name. She's the editorial and communications director there at the Center for Responsive Politics. Vivica, I appreciate you taking time for us. Thanks so much.
It's good to be with you.
All righty. Let's take a quick break. Back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show.
Smith Show.
Tales of American Political History with Clinton Porter Hackney.
We've begun the story of the establishment of our Pledge of Allegiance to the American flag, which occurred in 1892. Youth's Companion magazine had begun a crusade to put an American flag in every school in the nation to hopefully develop a stronger sense of unity needed to heal remaining wounds from the Civil War. Additionally, they'd come up with the idea of a Pledge of Allegiance. The magazine's owner, Daniel Ford, asked Francis Bellamy to write a pledge. Bellamy was a Baptist minister and a Christian socialist, but he was also a talented writer and author. Bellamy wrote a very brief pledge, and Ford approved. Ford and his marketer, James Upham, planned a huge rollout of their magazines, flags, and the pledge at schools everywhere in conjunction with the 400th anniversary of Christopher Columbus's discovery of America. Join us again to see how well it worked. This is Clinton Porter Hackney at cphackney.com.
Can antibiotic medicines, long hailed as miracle drugs, be too much of a good thing? Yes. Two factors are at work here. First, bacteria, one of the earliest forms of life on Earth, are miracles in their own right, with a stunning ability to outsmart the antibiotic drugs through rapid evolution. Second, is the rather dull inclination of us supposedly superior humans to overuse and misuse antibiotic medicines. Every time we take an antibiotic to kill some bad bacteria that is infecting our bodies, a few of the infectious germs are naturally resistant to the drug. So they survive, multiply, and become a colony of superbugs that antibiotics can't touch. Multiply this colony by the jillions of doses prescribed for everything from deadly staph infections to the common cold, and we get the, quote, antibiotic paradox. The more we use them, the less effective they become, for they're creating a spreading epidemic of immune superbugs. A big cause of this is the push by drug companies to get patients and doctors to reach for antibiotics as a cure-all. For example, millions of doses a year are prescribed for children and adults who have common colds, flu, sore throats, etc. Nearly all of these infections are caused by viruses, which cannot, repeat, cannot be cured with antibiotics. Taking an antibiotic for a cold is as useless as taking a heart drug for heartburn. The antibiotics will do nothing for your cold, but it will help establish drug-resistant superbugs in your body. That's not a smart trade-off. This is Jim Hightower saying, in fact, it's incomprehensibly stupid. Antibiotics are invaluable medicines we need for serious life-threatening illnesses, but squandering them on sore throats has already brought us to the brink of superbugs that are resistant to everything. That's the nightmare of all nightmares.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Free enterprise has done more to lift people out of poverty, to help build a strong middle class, to help educate our kids, and to make our lives better than all the programs of government combined.
Yes, we want it all, every bit of it, our millionaire class in Congress. And what's interesting is you've got a whole bunch of millionaire folks who, well, they want to be in Congress. So they're going to try and buy their way in. I remember the last Senate race, Casey ran against the multimillionaire, the coal baron, if you will, a guy named Tom Smith, who thought, hey, I'm going to buy my election. And not a very good candidate. Had he been a little more interesting, maybe a shot. Policies were horrible, though. Just bad. And now you look down in North Carolina, where the Tea Party is primarying the incumbent Republican Kay Hagan. And in fact, this guy who calls himself a wacko bird is actually leading the incumbent Kay Hagan, 45-43. He said that, and you got to love this, honestly, got to give him credit. And again, this is more of that dog whistle politic. It's that veiled racism. That he moved to North Carolina simply because he admired Jesse Helm. And that was the whole reason he went to North Carolina, because he admired the late segregationist. So there you go. Anyway, recently he said at a Tea Party rally that's just now come to light that, you know, we should do away with the entire Department of Agriculture and all the budget for the supplemental nutrition program. He says, we take our plunder. That's taken from us as individuals, given to the government, and the government is now keeping itself in power by giving these goodies away. And again, this is back to the election of 2012, the Paul Ryan rhetoric that, well, we're giving it to the urbans. Again, more of that dog whistle politic. He says that the answer is to get rid of the Department of Agriculture and, you know, get rid of those farm bill food stamps, because it enslaves people. You know, hey, feeding people, horrible, horrible. Then he went on to talk about the whole the teach a man to fish thing, which, again, you go back and I can't tell you how many times I've had people say, you know, it's in the Bible, Rick, don't you know? Don't you read your Bible? To teach a man to fish, he'll eat for a lifetime. You give him a fish, he'll only eat for a day. It's in the Bible. It's in there, black and white. And I often ask her, well, which Bible are you talking about? Chinese Proverbs? Yes, yes. But not in the Bible. But, you know, I guess whatever you got to do, right? Now, as you look through this, and you look at this assault on, again, on the poor, this is what this is. This is kicking someone who is unable to defend themselves, which is why I keep saying, look, even if you've never been a member of a labor union, you don't think you'll ever see any benefit from it, the fact that there are people in our society who are willing to stand up and have the economic ability to stand up and say, no, you're not going to kick me. We're going to fight back. This is what the wealth class of this country despises. They despise people who are willing to stand up and say no. They like dictatorial control. They don't want to have to sit down and negotiate. They don't want to have to talk about. They sure as hell don't want to open their books. What? You want some of our profit? I mean, think about this for a minute. We've been told for a generation now, pretty much when I grew up as a kid, and I saw it firsthand. When I grew up as a kid, that union job meant a pathway to the middle class, meant a pathway to opportunity, meant that there would be a decent wage, meant that there would be health care, meant that there would be some semblance of retirement security. That was the reality. And the wealth class of this country knew that because those unions collectively bargained for better wages, hours, and conditions. It's what unions do. And it's what really ticks off people like the Koch brothers. It's what really ticks off the very well-to-do. Because understand, the Koch brothers own a number of companies where the workers are unionized. And you got to know that they despise having to negotiate with them. They despise having a group of workers who are willing to go, you know what? We're going to do the only thing that we can do, and that's fold our arms and not work, unless you pay us a reasonable salary, that we get a reasonable portion of the wealth that we create. And they despise that, absolutely despise that. They want to impose. They want to dictate. Do as you're told. Don't open your mouth. Don't say a word. That's what this whole fight is over. There's always been in this country a push and pull between labor and capital. It's always been there. Always. Go back to the beginning of the country. Actually, from the beginning of time. And there's always been this push and pull back. And as soon as labor started to organize and to gain some strength, you saw almost immediately business types. You go back to 1947 when the Republicans passed Taft-Hartley and then passed it over a Truman veto, which set up this system that said, well, you know, if states want to, like you southern states, you can pass these right-to-work laws where those unions won't get a foothold. And we can continue to exploit you. And I mean, stop and think about the last 50, 60, 70 years of the South. Stop and think about it. Exploitation, poor wages, poor conditions. It's all right there in black and white. Let's take a quick break. When we come back in the third hour, we're going to talk a little bit about the Internet, going to talk a little bit about unemployment, a whole bunch of stuff to get to. Quick break, right back. We want the world and we want it now. We're going to take it anyhow. We want the airwaves.
Not right wing. Just right. The Rick Smith Show.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
Labor rights are civil rights. 46 years ago in Memphis, Tennessee, Dr. Martin Luther King advocated for workers' rights, equity, and justice. 50 years ago in Mississippi, progressive people issued a call. Progress in Mississippi depends on you, they said. The result of that call is what we know today as Freedom Summer. High on the agenda of the Mississippi Summer Project were the rights of workers.
Civil rights organizer and Mississippi Alliance for Fairness at Nissan member Frank Figures. Infused with the spirit and principles of the civil rights movement, Nissan workers at the Detroit Auto Show on Monday launched a new campaign in their drive to unionize the Nissan plant in Canton, Mississippi. It's called Tell Nissan, Labor Rights or Civil Rights, evoking the powerful grassroots movement that transformed the South. Chip Wells has worked for Nissan in Mississippi for nearly 11 years. He says when he was hired in, management told him they didn't want a union, what they called a third party, getting between Nissan and its workers. But experience has taught Wells that workers in Mississippi need that union.
Well, I'm telling you now, after 11 years, almost 11 years, we need that third party, that organization that we would lead, not that someone else would lead, us, the workers in Mississippi at Nissan plant, to sit down at the table with our managers and the company to decide what's best for us and not them telling us what's best for us without our input.
Workers trying to organize with the United Auto Workers say there are a host of serious issues at the Nissan plant, including erratic, unpredictable work schedules and safety issues and how injured workers are treated by Nissan.
Ergonomics. The same jobs that employees do repetitively lead to injuries. And then after a year, if you have that same injury and you can't report back to work, you're administratively terminated. And that is wrong. There's got to be a voice for the employee at the Canton, Mississippi plant.
Rafael Martinez is also a Nissan worker who supports joining the UAW. He says labor rights are civil rights at the Canton, Mississippi Nissan plant.
Labor rights are civil rights. So really, how are we affected by that? Well, we affect in a number of ways. One of the ways that we affected that, the company itself, they're trying to intimidate the workers not to have a union. The message that they're sending out there, that they're promoting, that all a union will do is shut the company down or move the company. That's not true.
Martinez says successful Nissan plants around the world have been union for years, and Mississippi workers just want the same labor and civil rights.
Workers Independent News is brought to you with support from union-owned and represented Bank of Labor, member FDIC, equal opportunity lender. The Bank of Labor is the bank of choice for unions and their members. Now you can do business with a bank that shares labor values. More info online at bankoflabor.com.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
There is no America. There is no democracy. There is only IBM and ITT and AT&T and DuPont, Dow, Union Carbide, and Exxon. Those are the nations of the world today.
Oh, boy, that isn't true. I mean, the power that we've given these huge multinational corporations, you got to stand back in awe and look at how we have just said, God, yeah, God, never mind. We're going to make sure that you don't have to. In fact, we'll pay you. We'll pay you. Come on, do your business here. We'll pay you. Amazing. Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. I was basically stuck in my tracks today when I saw this story from the governor of North Carolina, the Republican Pat McCrory, who over the weekend had some really interesting claims. His claim was that the reason the unemployment rate went down by 1% in North Carolina was because they destroyed those generous unemployment benefits. Think about this for a second. In fact, what they did is now I guess you don't even get the 26 weeks. Now, there are a number of, because of the federal extensions, if your state took the federal extensions, could be up to 99 weeks. I guess in North Carolina, it's down to 19 weeks. Under the normal 26 weeks, well under. I mean, you're talking about an extra 7 weeks cut away from you at a time when unemployment, long-term unemployment, is at an all-time high. Now, how'd they do it? How did they get a 1% reduction in their unemployment at a time when the rest of the country is kind of kind of stagnant. What they did was simple. They shrank the number of people in the labor force. In fact, labor participation in the state of North Carolina is at a 37-year low. And if you look at the chart that they show, it's really, really low. Completely dropping, dropping out of any range that they've ever been in. And, you know, this guy's saying, well, it's because we cut our generous benefits. In fact, they went and they cut. I complained about here in Pennsylvania how we froze our unemployment benefits for the next decade. So inflation will eat it away. What they did in North Carolina is they actually cut it to where you could lose almost $200 a week. And I'm looking at this going, explain to me how it is that this claim that because they cut the unemployment rate, they cut the number of weeks, they cut the amount that you get, how that had anything to do with people leaving the state and going home. Because that was the other part of this. It was because all those people, they're going home because we used to have generous benefits. Now they're not here. And that's really a very stupid thing to say. But I got to wonder how many of the Republican faithful just kind of shake their head and go, oh, yeah, they went home. Understand, and just about every state in this country, if you're laid off, well, let's say you're laid off here in Pennsylvania and you want to move to Ohio. This is what happened to me, actually. I'll give it the personal story. I got laid off in Cleveland back in 1993. And it just happened to be my ex-wife, her parents were terminally ill, and we decided, neither of us had jobs. She had just gotten out of college. And, you know, the job she had, well, it wasn't great, and she was looking for a new one, and I didn't have a job, so it's like, fine, let's go. When I came to Pennsylvania, I collected unemployment from Ohio. I had to report to their unemployment office, and then I had to have it transferred here. Ohio still paid the unemployment. I didn't get Pennsylvania's unemployment. I got Ohio's. So this idea that, well, they came here for the generous benefits, they got laid off in Mississippi, and then made the trip to North Carolina, ludicrous. And as the report shows, you've got to be in the state for 6 months of the last 15 months and had worked in the state in order for you to collect unemployment benefits. So just right on the face of this statement by this governor, flat wrong. Absolutely dead wrong. But you got to kind of wonder when you're speaking to the faithful, facts don't really matter. Anecdotal evidence is all you really need. I heard from a guy who saw a guy who saw a woman down in the corner who said. And that's all you really need, right? How many times have you heard those kind of stories? I know a guy who knows a guy who saw a girl do this over there, and this is what happened. And, you know, most of the time it's just total, completely made up BS. But when a sitting governor in a state like North Carolina, or even here in Pennsylvania, the governor here saying, well, the unemployed are lazy, stupid, or drug addicts, they can't pass drug tests, is ridiculous. Again, anecdotal. But what's interesting to me, and I happened to read Thomas Friedman's piece, who I'm not a huge Thomas Friedman fan, understand that. I read his piece over the weekend. It was called If I Had a Hammer, and where he kind of gives a, you know, a little bit of overview on this book called The Second Machine Age. And he talks about, you know, looking towards the future. And this book, I guess it's really not his opinion more than it's the book that he's talking about. That, you know, you had the first machine age, which was the Industrial Revolution. And you saw machines taking over the heavy muscular stuff. Humans were still running the machines. It was just, you know, they were doing a lot of heavy lifting and a lot of improvements in power. More power, you know, a little more speed, but mostly power. They're saying now that, you know, the second machine age, because we've gone from connected to hyper-connected almost overnight. And they're saying this second machine age, where they write, we're at the beginning to automate a lot more cognitive tasks, a lot more of the control systems that determine what to use that power for. They write, in many cases, today artificially intelligent machines can make better decisions than human beings. And they say, look, you know, there's software out there that make human beings not just redundant, but useless. And, you know, they're saying that, you know, with the amount of technology out there, eventually machines are going to do most of the jobs. And I spent a couple of hours, you know, just thinking this through. I read a bunch of the comments, which I know I shouldn't be reading the crazy comments, where people are saying, yeah, we should have the machines do all of the work and we do the creative stuff. I'm going, really? And how many jobs are going to be in that? What kind of an economy are you going to build out of that? And I stop and I think about the unemployment, and there's a point to all of this. You know, I listen to everyone say, well, we should do away with food stamps, and we should do away with earned income tax credits, and we should do away with food stamps and unemployment and all of these social safety net programs that make sure that everyone in this country at least is somewhere near the poverty line. Let's say we follow this second machine age to where these folks say it's going to go, to where technology just keeps doubling every short period of time. You know, I think they said that technology over a 70-year period doubled, to where now it's almost yearly, where you're having this technological surge. Everything's bigger, everything's faster, everything's just growing at such a pace. Cars that drive themselves, you know, supercomputers that you know, do all this amazing stuff. Smartphones that you put in your pocket that have the computing power of supercomputers just a generation ago. You look at all this technological advance and you go, what's going to happen to workers? What's going to happen to people who need to feed their families? And one of the comments that caught my attention is, well, you know, people want to work. That's their identity. And I stopped in my tracks and said, really, is that the reality? That we're a nation of people who the only thing that we can identify ourselves with is what we do for a living? And sadly, you know, you kind of got to wonder. I'm of the mindset that the vast majority, and maybe I'm wrong, and maybe you'll disagree with me, but I'm of the mindset that most people go to work every day, not because they absolutely love what they do and they can't think of anything better to do today, but this is how they feed their families. This is how they put a roof over their head. This is how they make it to the next day. This is how they save for retirement. What happens when those jobs go away? Look at our trade policies. Look at our trade agreements. We're at a time right now where those white-collar jobs that, you know, all of us aspired for, you know, my grandparents' generation told us, oh, you don't want to be a truck driver. Oh, you don't want to do factory work. You don't want to work in the mill. You don't want to do any of those jobs. You want a corner office somewhere. We're shuffling papers across the desk, making decisions in a nice white shirt and tie. Well, you know what? While the factory jobs are going away and the mill and the productive jobs, the manufacturing jobs, are going the way, not just of the trade deal, but also of mechanization and the robotics, so are those white-collar jobs. You know, you look at Wall Street. The Wall Street traders are supercomputers who do things in milliseconds. And the question then becomes, what will people do? And, you know, Friedman, you know, goes and asks that question. You know, as this stuff is going on, what is the job market going to look like? And he points to this thing. He says, you know, put all of these advances together, according to the authors, and you can see that our generation will have more power to improve or destroy the world than ever before. Relying on fewer people and more technology, they say, but it also means that we need to rethink deeply our social contracts, because labor is so important to a person's identity and dignity and to societal stability. The authors, he writes, suggest that we consider lowering taxes on human labor to make it cheaper relative to digital labor, that we reinvent education so more people can race with machines, not against them, that we do more to foster the entrepreneurship that invents new industries and jobs, and even consider guaranteeing every American a basic income. And I go back to Milton Friedman's idea of a negative tax. Not Thomas Friedman, Uncle Milty, the long-gone Uncle Milty. Is this something that we will reconsider at some point? Because eventually, there aren't going to be enough jobs, as there are not now. And as I look at unemployment and I look at the long-term unemployed, there are not enough jobs right now. And I got to wonder if there ever will be as we move forward, as we continue to mechanize. But it's an interesting thought. Lower the taxes on human labor and increase the tax on digital labor. Interesting, interesting thought. Quick break. Back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show.
This is the Media Matters Minute. I'm Coleman Lowndes. Fox's senior political analyst Britt Hume defended Chris Christie's political vendettas in the wake of the ongoing bridge scandal on Fox News' Media Buzz. When asked about Christie's emerging bully narrative by host Howard Kurtz, Hume deflects blame from Christie onto today's, quote, feminized atmosphere.
So what about this bully narrative?
Well, I would have to say that in this sort of feminized atmosphere in which we exist today, guys who were masculine and muscular like that in their private conduct and kind of old-fashioned tough guys run some risks.
Later, on The O'Reilly Factor, Hume kept digging, saying that politicians being labeled racist or sexist is an unfortunate side effect of the civil rights and women's rights movements.
One of the worst things that can ever be said about you, politically fatal if it sticks, is that you're a racist. It is also the case that if you're accused of being a sexist, and that can be made to stick, that's also very damaging.
Yeah.
So in some respects, these triumphs have the side effect of placing a cudgel in the hands of people who are willing to use them, and at times unscrupulously.
For more on this and other stories, please visit MediaMatters.org.
Can antibiotic medicines, long hailed as miracle drugs, be too much of a good thing? Yes. Two factors are at work here. First, bacteria, one of the earliest forms of life on Earth, are miracles in their own right, with a stunning ability to outsmart the antibiotic drugs through rapid evolution. Second, is the rather dull inclination of us supposedly superior humans to overuse and misuse antibiotic medicines. Every time we take an antibiotic to kill some bad bacteria that is infecting our bodies, a few of the infectious germs are naturally resistant to the drug. So they survive, multiply, and become a colony of superbugs that antibiotics can't touch. Multiply this colony by the jillions of doses prescribed for everything from deadly staph infections to the common cold, and we get the, quote, antibiotic paradox. The more we use them, the less effective they become. For they're creating a spreading epidemic of immune superbugs. A big cause of this is the push by drug companies to get patients and doctors to reach for antibiotics as a cure-all. For example, millions of doses a year are prescribed for children and adults who have common colds, flu, sore throats, etc. Nearly all of these infections are caused by viruses, which cannot, repeat, cannot be cured with antibiotics. Taking an antibiotic for a cold is as useless as taking a heart drug for heartburn. The antibiotics will do nothing for your cold, but it will help establish drug-resistant superbugs in your body. That's not a smart trade-off. This is Jim Hightower saying, in fact, it's incomprehensibly stupid. Antibiotics are invaluable medicines we need for serious life-threatening illnesses, but squandering them on sore throats has already brought us to the brink of superbugs that are resistant to everything. That's the nightmare of all nightmares.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Can antibiotic
minimum wage! Yeah!
You know what it means when they pay you minimum wage? You know what they're trying to tell you? It's like, hey, if I could pay you less, I would.
You know, I've often thought, you know, that the Republicans should be the champion of raising the minimum wage because they're anti-government, they don't believe in government programs, and they keep telling us that they believe in the rewards of work, that if you go to work, you should be able to support yourself. Yet you find people like Arthur Laffer, who last week said that the minimum wage was the Black Teenage Unemployment Act because, you know, he knows that they have poor skills, and no one would ever take a chance on those people at $7.25 an hour. No, they should take it down to $4 or $5 an hour, as the resident scholar Michael Strain from the American Enterprise Institute said, $4 minimum wage, that would end our long-term unemployment problem. Get all those people back working for $4 an hour. And then you ask the question, okay, let's say we do that. Who in this country can live on $4 an hour? Oh, yeah, absolutely no one. Honestly, no one. I don't know. I don't care. I don't care how you squeeze the quarter. You can squeeze the quarter till the eagle screams. You're not going to make it to the end of the month. Not going to happen. So does that mean more subsidy programs? Does that mean more LIHEAP, more food stamps, more Section 8 housing? Does it mean more assistance programs? And the answer is yes. So we're now creating an even lower low-wage economy. That's the Republican view. Understand that. The Republican view is we need to have the lowest wages possible and government subsidies. Set up our business model on, we hate government, but we love the subsidies. We hate government, but we love free money. That's the reality. I came across this story about this guy named Ron Unz. He is a conservative multimillionaire, a longtime Republican donor, has run for office in California a number of times over the years. Last time, I guess, was some, I guess, 94. I guess he ran for governor. He's advocating a $12 an hour minimum wage. And exactly as I've said that conservatives should be, that the pro-business types should be, saying that, I mean, Mitt Romney said that he was in favor of, at one point, now he walked away from it, but he did say that he was in favor of tying the minimum wage to the inflation, to some measure of inflation, so wages keep going up and don't get eroded away. But you would think that conservatives would jump on this because you don't want to subsidize business. You don't want to pick winners and losers in the business community based on who's paying lower wages and getting subsidies from government. Now, this is this guy's argument. We want to get government out of everything, right? You want to get rid of food stamps. You want to get rid of, all of the assistance programs that create sloth and indifference and make people lazy and soft. Want them to work. Well, he's saying $12 minimum wage would get people back to work, and we wouldn't have to pay in subsidies. And he points out that, according to the numbers that they've thrown out, about $250 million each and every year from 2007 to 2011 went to public assistance programs. I would have to imagine that's only in California. Now, what he's saying is, you eliminate these corporations' ability to pay crummy wages, and you could save, over a five-year span, and again, I guess this is only in California, you could have saved the taxpayers there $1 trillion, which is, I think it was Everett Dirksen who said, a billion here, a billion there, you're talking some real money. $1 trillion, that's some real money. So now you've got this conservative out here saying, well, this is what we need to do. Now, what he also goes into is what I've said a million times. Now, this is a multi-million dollar software mogul. This is Mr. Pro Business. He's saying, if we raise the minimum wage,
it could be a stimulus. Could get the economy going, get money into people's pockets, and you know what? They might spend it. And they might spend it in your business. Now, here's the thing that gets me. It's one of those things that kind of just leaves you scratching your head. When you look at the polling on this, especially in a political environment where people live and die by the latest polls, everybody's got to do a poll. Oh, we got to have polling. We got to have numbers. We got to have, which I got to be honest, most polls are BS. You know that. But when the numbers are so heavily in favor of raising the minimum wage, as you see, 75-80% of people saying, yeah, we need to raise the minimum wage. People need to make a decent living. When you see 6 in 10 Republicans going, you know, we should raise the minimum wage, and the party doing nothing, you kind of got to wonder. When you see efforts in states like Alaska and Arkansas, Idaho, New Mexico, South Dakota, when you see them going, hey, you know what? Our minimum wages are going to go up either through new laws or automatic inflation-adjusted indexes. You kind of got to go, okay, somebody's got on the right page here. Because of these automatic indexes and because of new laws, 1.5 million workers are going to have more money in their pocket. And what's that going to mean? And what we're going to be able to see by the end of this year, will those states have more economic activity? I would argue that yes, and I would argue that Mr. Unz, he knows that, because he's a business guy, right? They understand. And this is what's always kind of made me stop in my tracks and wonder, why is it that the conservatives have always been so dead set against, or at least in the last 20 years, dead set against raising the minimum wage, dead set against the prevailing wage, getting people a decent standard of living? Why? And to me, it's got to come back to some hatred of power in the hands of workers. That's one of the few things I can come up with. Now, understand, this low-wage economy that we've allowed to prop up, you know, Walmart alone on the federal level, $1.2 billion in tax breaks, free land, infrastructure, all of these subsidies we're giving just to one company, $1.2 billion a year. You look at the fast food industry, of the 7 publicly traded corporations, we've handed them billions of dollars. The one number I saw was somewhere around $4 billion each and every year goes into the fast food industry because of their low wage structure. And you look at this and you go, okay, $1.2 billion of that goes to McDonald's alone. Now, this is an industry that's extraordinarily profitable. They pay their CEOs and their chief executives huge amounts of money. Yet, they claim, can't afford to pay. Can't do it. Sorry, can't do it. Yet, when they come out with a website on how to budget your money, poor people, they give you a second full-time job. Now, had minimum wage, and I've said these before, and I think these are so important to remember, had minimum wage kept pace with productivity, minimum wage would be $21.72 an hour. $21.72 an hour. Now, stop and think about this for a second. Because we like to talk about redistribution of wealth. Had wages kept pace with productivity, the minimum wage would have been $21.72 an hour. The minimum wage is $7.25 an hour throughout the country. Some states have it higher, and I read off a couple of them. Where did the difference from $7.25 to $21.72, where did that go? I mean, honestly, think about this. If the minimum wage were supposed to be $21.72 and all you got was $7.25 of it, who got the rest of it? Who benefited from those productivity gains? If you didn't, if the person who created the wealth, if you didn't get the money, who got it? And I think we know who got it. The Koch brothers and the very well-to-do in this country, the Wall Street types. Had the minimum wage kept up with the growth of the people who are benefiting, the top 1%, who saw an increase of 212% over the last 30 years, had the federal minimum wage kept up with the 1% and their earnings, the minimum wage would be about $22.62 an hour. So I ask that question again. If the minimum wage is 7.25, and it should be, you know, if we do it that way, $22.62 an hour, who got the rest? Where'd it go? Oh, yeah! How do you think the 1% saw a 212% increase? Huh. Just asking the question. So when somebody said to me recently, you don't actually support a $15 an hour wage for those fast food workers, I said, yeah, actually I do. How can you do that? Well, you know, look, these people create an awful lot of wealth. They come in and they bust their behind and they work, and they deal with people, which I can't imagine. I got to be honest. I cannot imagine having to put up with some of the nonsense that I've seen over the years. When you go into these fast food restaurants or any restaurant, whenever you're dealing with the public, I feel for you, which is why I try to be extraordinarily nice and try to be, you know, as reasonable as possible to folks who do those jobs, because I can't imagine how difficult it is having to deal with people who are just, well, that's a whole other argument. But, you know, you look at this and the reality, so much money being redistributed from you, the ones who created it, to those who want more. And what do they do with the money that you give them? They use it to push for laws to get them even more. Which is why I'm hoping this whole fight here in the state over this anti-worker agenda that's going on, I'm hoping it ignites some passion in people. I'm hoping it ignites a response. Now, I mean, a couple minutes ago, the legislative director for Pennsylvania for LIUNA said, well, you know, they had a meeting and maybe it's not going to be, who knows, it doesn't look like it's really going to move. Maybe it will, maybe it won't. I'd like to say they're going to try and ram it through as like thieves in the night. And I want people to be active and organized, and I want people out in the street. That's why I think on January 28th, next Tuesday, or two Tuesdays from now, the people show up at the Capitol, 10 a.m. at the Capitol Rotunda, just to show up and say, you know what, stop. Stop the insanity. Who is that woman, the diet woman? I think her name was Susan Powder or something. Her tagline was, stop the insanity! We need to stop the insanity. Quick break, right back with Talk Radio News Service. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people from the talk. Get up.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
Labor rights are civil rights. 46 years ago in Memphis, Tennessee, Dr. Martin Luther King advocated for workers' rights, equity, and justice. 50 years ago in Mississippi, progressive people issued a call. Progress in Mississippi depends on you, they said. The result of that call is what we know today as Freedom Summer. High on the agenda of the Mississippi Summer Project were the rights of workers.
Civil rights organizer and Mississippi Alliance for Fairness at Nissan member Frank Figures. Infused with the spirit and principles of the civil rights movement, Nissan workers at the Detroit Auto Show on Monday launched a new campaign in their drive to unionize the Nissan plant in Canton, Mississippi. It's called Tell Nissan, Labor Rights or Civil Rights, evoking the powerful grassroots movement that transformed the South. Chip Wells has worked for Nissan in Mississippi for nearly 11 years. He says when he was hired in, management told him they didn't want a union, what they called a third party, getting between Nissan and its workers. But experience has taught Wells that workers in Mississippi need that union.
Well, I'm telling you now, after 11 years, almost 11 years, we need that third party, that organization that we would lead, not that someone else would lead, us, the workers in Mississippi at Nissan plant, to sit down at the table with our managers and the company to decide what's best for us and not them telling us what's best for us without without our input.
Workers trying to organize with the United Auto Workers say there are a host of serious issues at the Nissan plant, including erratic, unpredictable work schedules and safety issues, and how injured workers are treated by Nissan.
Ergonomics. The same jobs that employees do repetitively lead to injuries. And then after a year, if you have that same injury and you can't report back to work, you're administratively terminated. And that is wrong. There's got to be a voice for the employee at the Canton, Mississippi plant.
Rafael Martinez is also a Nissan worker who supports joining the UAW. He says labor rights are civil rights at the Canton, Mississippi Nissan plant.
Labor rights are civil rights. So really, how are we affected by that? Well, we are affected in a number of ways. One of the ways that we are affected that the company itself, they try to intimidate the workers not to have a union. The message that they're sending out there, that they're promoting, that all a union would do is shut the company down or move the company. That's not true.
Martinez says successful Nissan plants around the world have been union for years, and Mississippi workers just want the same labor and civil rights.
Workers Independent News is brought to you with support from union-owned and represented Bank of Labor, member FDIC, equal opportunity lender. The Bank of Labor is the bank of choice for unions and their members. Now you can do business with a bank that shares labor values. More info online at bankoflabor.com.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickssmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind? You can email me, Rick at therickssmithshow.com. So evidently, in Wyoming, the financial situation is so bad, and the killing people in prison thing so bad, that the state is now exploring some creative ways to kill people on death row. Since evidently there's a shortage of the drugs that will kill you, which I cannot believe that there's a shortage of drugs that will kill you, but evidently there is. And in Wyoming, they're talking about bringing back firing squads. So there you go. I'm sure the NRA will be 110% behind that idea. Anyway, let's find out what's going on in Washington, D.C., around the world. Bob Nay, Talk Radio News Service. Bob, thanks for taking time for us.
Well, thank you. How are you?
I'm good. I can't imagine that there's a big shortage of drugs that will kill you in this country. Maybe just drink the water in West Virginia or something.
I was just listening to you talk about that, and I thought, wow, you know, that's incredible. I mean, the alternative is you're going to have a firing squad?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, find a drug that works versus the gun. If they're going to do that.
Well, you know, I guess it's the lobbying, you know. Hey, you know, and maybe, you know, and the good part of this is you could, if you did this, I'm sure you could find sponsors. Maybe you could get the Duck Dynasty people to come on board. So maybe even use the gun that they rolled out during their whole fake controversy. And you could have sponsors and billboards. Make an event out of it.
I mean, we don't execute that many people per day in America that they would run out of the drug. Somebody wants to have a firing squad. I mean, we don't execute, you know, 25 people a day, and we can't get a hold of the drug.
Yeah, maybe there are some people who want to start. That's all I can think of.
Possibly.
Anyway, maybe the budgets are that tight. Who knows? I understand, you know, looking on the federal level, that we passed a three-day funding bill. I guess it's one way of running our government. I doubt it's a good way, but it's definitely one way.
Well, 12-step programs one day at a time, and our government's 3 days at a time. So I think that they are coming to the point, though, they're going to pass in the House the $1 trillion sum, which will take us to October, and then the Senate will pass it, and the White House will sign it. So eventually they're actually getting multiple months now, eventually.
Wow.
First days.
So
they're getting somewhere.
And that's amazing. So then the question I have, because, you know, now I'm kind of depressed, because then the 24-style hostage situations, are those the things, are those so 2010, 11, and 12?
Well, you know, there's the winners and losers in this budget, too. And so many, you know, stories have been out there that a lot of this is not being talked about, what's actually in the guts of that thing.
Well, as a former congressman, what do you see in it that you like? What do you see in it that you don't like?
Well, they didn't ravage Head Start. I mean, if we want to pick out some individual things, that's fine. Ironically, when everybody's complaining, Rick, about Benghazi and, you know, the security, there's a $245 million cut in there for security for the State Department, which applies to embassies.
Yeah, but we both know that the Benghazi, all of the stuff about Benghazi, has nothing to do with actually what went on in Benghazi.
Right.
Don't we? I mean, I think we know that this is a political witch hunt, not to solve whatever problems we had and make sure that it never happens again. It's just a political witch hunt to put someone's head on a stick.
Yeah. So those who complain about Benghazi, you're going to vote to cut security for embassies. So I think it shows, you know, the hypocrisy actually of that. And there's some other things. There's a little bit of pork in this here and there, of course, and some funding measures. But overall, you know, they are agreeing on the discretionary funding because they could have, you know, sliced more. So it's a maintenance budget, I want to call it.
How much of the Screwquester money went back? Have we moved? I saw that the money that they had taken from military pensions and the disabled military vets in the future, I see that they corrected that, right?
Yes, but ironically, as the Senate, the two Republicans in the Senate, from Nevada, from Harry Reid's state, are putting together a measure which is 3 months funding of the unemployment versus 11 months, and it takes it from military pensions, part of it.
Yeah, that's really bad messaging. And stupid. And to me, really very stupid. I mean, if you're going to make these promises, I think you do have to keep them, right?
Yeah, I mean, if you're going to, in 1 month, you're going to restore military pensions, and the next, you introduce a bill to take them away, it just doesn't make much sense.
Well, we giveth with one hand, we taketh with the other.
Take from the other.
It doesn't make a lot of sense. And, you know, I look at what's going on in West Virginia right now as they're drinking the toxic sludge water. And, you know, I got to ask, you know, on the regulatory side, on the oversight side, I don't know if you saw John Boehner said, we don't need any more regulations. It's Obama's fault, much like Benghazi, it's Obama's fault that this place hadn't been inspected. Never mind that Republicans for at least a generation now have been pushing deregulation and cutting funding for the few regulators and overseers that we actually have. But never mind what's behind the curtain. It's that guy's fault.
This one amazed me. It really did, even for John Boehner. I'm born in Wheeling, West Virginia, and I lived across the river, you know, from West Virginia, and Ohio is a bordering state, et cetera. And so he knows the picture and the scope of what's happened down there. At Charleston, it's devastating what has happened in Charleston, West Virginia. And we don't know the full ramifications, the full implications, and who did what yet. Yet he already says, well, you know, we have enough regulations. He doesn't know.
No.
He doesn't know the details of this. And to come out there is this touting. I mean, he may not even be getting contributions for this. He might just be, you know, his mindset is there is, you know, no regulation he ever saw that he liked.
Yeah, it's just a knee-jerk gut reaction. That's the talking point, and you got to spew that out. But what's interesting to me is, as you look at this story, Freedom Industries, basically, they're free to do whatever the hell they want because they're a storage facility in West Virginia, which evidently they're exempt from their EPA laws there.
Yes, there's an exemption. The owner, the president, came in and he immediately flew out of town. You know, that caused a lot of ill feeling. He wasn't even addressing the situation. And there's got to be talk about compensation. I mean, this was a leak. This was their fault.
Yeah, well, and you know what I find interesting is the day that the leak happened, the members of the House of Representatives actually passed a law repealing some of the Superfund language, which I just thought I thought very interesting.
What timing? That's amazing.
No, I don't say that. You know, no, look, I'm sure it wasn't. It was just coincidence, but it's just it's amazing. I mean, it just is what it is.
Sure. And then on the heels of doing that, this comes up, you know, bad timing, obviously.
And you would think that, you know, with this now there would be some outrage. But I seriously doubt nothing changes in 3-6 months. I mean, there'll be some soapbox speeches. There'll be some heated rhetoric. But at the end of it, coal rules supreme in West Virginia and the moneyed interests. No, we can't be overseeing that stuff. That'd get people all worked up. Can't have that.
We talked about this actually earlier today on a couple of stations that are close to that area. And what we were talking about is, you know, for years, they could do, or the companies could do as they please. As long as they provide the jobs, people turned a blind eye to it. I thought really that kind of stopped in modern day times, but obviously, you know, maybe it hasn't.
No, Bob, when we did our labor history tour, and I think I may have told you this already, we went into Blair, West Virginia, and we were met by a welcoming committee with sidearms and, you know, the whole nine yards. Because, you know, where's that New Jersey plate RV thing coming from? And, you know, we were met by this welcoming committee who, they were defending the coal they had friends of coal everything, belt buckles and bumper stickers and T-shirts and you name it, friends of coal everything. And, you know, even as you're talking to them about, do you not realize that these companies are stealing your pensions and degrading your environment? They knew that, but hey, we need the jobs. So even in this day, it's right there front and center.
Well, yes, in a desperate economy, you know, again, and that's why some companies actually function in areas where the economy is desperate because they can get away with a little bit more, obviously.
Yeah. And speaking of desperate workers, again, you know, here at the end of just after Christmas, and Merry Christmas to you, 1.3 million unemployed, long-term unemployed workers, now you can starve. Still no extension of the unemployment benefits. There was a glimmer of hope that the Senate had passed something through. Now it's being filibustered, as I understand.
Well, it is. And also the alternative that the Republicans in the Senate have come up with is just a dandy. Again, it goes into the military pensions. Why on earth would someone pick military pensions, of all things, to tinker with in funding anything? I mean, it doesn't make sense. In fact, I thought Harry Reid gave him a break of introducing the bill because he was really giving them a hangman's noose.
Yeah.
To the public.
Explain this to me then. You know, what is it about these pensions? Is it current pensioners, people who are near pension age? Is it, you know, down the road? Where is this money coming from? Is it us going back and saying retroactively, sorry, we gave you too much, we're taking it away? What exactly is it?
Well, they wouldn't be able to go back retroactively on anything, but it could be increases in pension. So, you know, they would stop any future increases. And again, to even talk about doing anything to military pensions, they're set. You know, you sign up, you have a deal, you know what you're going to get, and you can't alter that. Again, the whole issue doesn't make sense on the Republican side of fighting an extension on unemployment. What they should have done is supported it. Don't take away the safety net. And by the way, once they support it, they would have the ability to say, hey, we had to support this because the president just, you know, isn't getting the economy cured.
Yep.
You know, they could have made that political argument. Now they have no argument.
Yeah, but how can they go back and, you know, yeah, I get you, but how could they go back and say, okay, we're going to extend the unemployment when you've got governors like Tom Corbett here in Pennsylvania who ran in 2010 on the unemployed are just lazy and stupid, and then last year said they're drug addicts. You know, how can you then, you know, go back and say, okay, we're going to extend it when the party really has taken this line that if you're unemployed, there's something wrong with you?
But I don't get that. You know, Rob Portman, our senator from Ohio, you know what he said yesterday was, well, you know, we have to be competitive in the global marketplace. The only way we can be competitive is to make slave labor like China does. I mean, they're not even making valid arguments.
Yeah,
Rick.
It's that kind of stuff that makes me wonder, you know, who's advising these folks. And I don't know if you saw this billionaire guy, a very conservative Republican, out, in fact, ran for governor years ago under the Republican ticket, calling now for an increase in the minimum wage, saying, hey, you know, we've got to stop this low-wage economy where we're handing big business tons of money. And, you know, I'm hoping at some point the Republican Party comes around and wakes up to the fact that people need to have jobs and they need to have decent-paying jobs.
With decent-paying jobs, and nothing's wrong with a prevailing wage, and on top of it, and it used to be this way, even during Gingrich's time, Rick, you had enough people speaking out on the Republican side that, you know, they didn't mess with Davis Bacon, you know, living wages, prevailing wages, that wasn't tinkered with because Republicans would put their foot down and say, no, we're not doing it.
No.
You know, attack fiscal responsibility, just don't attack the people that can't help if they're unemployed.
I mean, it's amazing to me. And what I think should be coming out of this, and this is where I think the Republicans would have a perfect talking point saying, we can't extend unemployment anymore. We just can't do it. But We're going to come up with jobs plans. If you want a job, we're going to make sure that you get a job. And government will be the employer of last resort. No more unemployment because we believe it's a handout. You can earn your way. And I think a lot of people would buy into it.
Yes, they would. And again, if the economy were rolling along, you know, it would be a whole different world.
Yep.
On an extension. But it's not rolling along.
So how'd the Pentagon fare in this budget talk?
Well, you know, the Pentagon is going to be able to make some cuts and is going to be able to trim back its budget. But at the end of the day, I mean, they're not going to go under by any stretch of imagination.
$527 billion they got.
That's right. And so some of the sequestration is being obviously reversed.
That's almost half our entire budget.
Amazing.
Almost half. Amazing.
And we're not really technically in any wars right now.
Yeah, I mean, this isn't the Cold War where we're trying to force someone into bankruptcy, except maybe us. But that's a whole other argument. Let's look at the IRS. Evidently, there was a report out. The FBI found the IRS didn't break any laws. That's got to make conservatives lose their mind.
Well, you know, Congressman Issa, who chaired the committee and went after this issue, is furious. But at the end of the day, when you look at this, the IRS was looking into and at conservative and liberal because that's what they're supposed to do. They're supposed to look at groups to see if they qualify for tax status, you know, if they qualify to be, you know, a nonprofit or if they're not using it for political purposes. So they didn't look into one group. They looked into anybody that applied, and that's what they're supposed to do.
And at the time, you had all of these Tea Party groups applying, and there were a number of liberal groups as well that got hung up in this. It wasn't just, hey, let's go after these very limited groups. It was the whole ball of wax, which never got reported in our corporate controlled media.
Well, once it got, you know, once they spun the story that it was a conservative group only, that thing just ran and ran and ran. And then, of course, you add in a couple other sensational stories, and it doesn't get out there.
Yeah. And lastly, the governor of New Jersey admitted, you know, hey, there were some mistakes made. There were some mistakes made. What did you think of the performance?
Well, actually, now, I wouldn't have said this 2 days ago, but now because of the new scandal, I would say that the first scandal is not going to be the one that's the nail in the coffin. I think it's the second scandal with the auditors looking into how he spent the money. If there's even one hint of the use of money for political purposes from a disaster, he's toast.
Yeah. I mean, the last thing you want is people sniffing around. I think he tried, I do, I think to his credit, he tried to say, it was my fault, let it go, I take full responsibility, you don't have to look into it anymore, we'll deal with it, just to get people out of his state and off of his back, but I don't see this stuff going away.
No, the first one, again, I thought he dealt, you know, and decently with it, and I think that he would have had some ability to, you know, cope with it, and unless there was an email that said, hey, stop the lanes. But this second one, again, if the auditors find anything out of order, people do not take to the fact that anyone uses a disaster for their own benefit.
Yeah, I mean, that's really bad. I mean, that would almost be like, you know, I think it was Pat Robertson who was taking money from disaster relief. His planes were flying relief aid somewhere, and they took a little bit of it for themselves, as I remember the story going. But what's interesting is, you know, the Republican governors haven't, you know, they've actually rallied around him. In fact, here in Pennsylvania, the governor here, Tom Corbett, his spokesman said they would welcome Christie to come in and campaign for him. But I guess it couldn't hurt. I mean, even if the scandal does stink up Christie, his approval numbers have still got to be better than Corbett's.
Possibly true. But they may not have this same tune next month.
Yeah. Well, Corbett's numbers are between 20. I've seen one poll, 24% and 36% is the high. So,
mine weren't even that bad when the government was down my throat. So.
Yeah. Again, this is not a very popular governor. But here again, when you're destroying public education, when you're kicking the most vulnerable while they're down, when you're doing a lot of the things that they've done, attacking workers and all of this stuff, trying to privatize everything. I think people realize exactly what you're doing, and they're not happy, which is why I can't wait till November. Anyway, Bob, it's always great talking with you. Appreciate the time.
Thanks
so much. Our good friend Bob Nay, Talk Radio News Service. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. For working people, come to talk. Never you will look back and give me fight on to the end. Together we will live on forevermore. Now we have defended from all things done good. Now we are defenseless.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
Tales of American Political History with Clinton Porter Hackney.
We've begun the story of the establishment of our Pledge of Allegiance to the American flag, which occurred in 1892. Youth's Companion magazine had begun a crusade to put an American flag in every school in the nation to hopefully develop a stronger sense of unity needed to heal remaining wounds from the Civil War. Additionally, they'd come up with the idea of a Pledge of Allegiance. The magazine's owner, Daniel Ford, asked Francis Bellamy to write a pledge. Bellamy was a Baptist minister and a Christian socialist, but he was also a talented writer and author. Bellamy wrote a very brief pledge and Ford approved. Ford and his marketer, James Upham, planned a huge rollout of their magazines, flags, and the pledge at schools everywhere in conjunction with the 400th anniversary of Christopher Columbus's discovery of America. Join us again to see how well it worked. This is Clinton Porter Hackney at cphackney.com.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny. We'll preserve for our children this, the last best hope of man on earth, or we'll sentence them to take the last step into 1,000 years of darkness.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Of course, if you missed any portion of the program, you can download the podcast there at the website or get the Stitcher app on the smartphone. Take the program on the go, and you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Do answer all emails personally. And, you know, you can get it on the Internet, you know, while you still can. Interesting decision today by the D.C. Circuit Court, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit, that found that the Federal Communications Commission, they don't have the power to mandate the net neutrality rules. In fact, you know, what they're saying is net neutrality rules were issued by the FCC to prevent broadband providers from favoring some content over others. So, like, you know where this goes. These well-funded conservative programs, Limbaugh, for instance, Hannity, the rest of these, where the big money is pushing them, they get preferential treatment over everybody else. So their content more important than yours, or whatever the approved content of the day is. And what they point out, according to the two-judge majority, they point out that a broadband provider like Comcast might limit its end-user subscriptions' ability to access the New York Times website if it wanted to spike traffic to its own news website, or it might degrade the quality of the connection in search website like Bing if a competitor like Google paid for a prioritized access. And, you know, they admit, look, they concede to the fact that broadband providers represent a threat to the Internet openness and could act in ways that would ultimately inhibit the speed and extent of future broadband deployment. Basically what they're saying is, well, we're going to decide with the people who we know are going to stick it to you and are going to control what you see, what you hear, what you read. This is really, really power. Tomorrow, we're going to try and hunt down some folks to talk about this. Because here again, another big issue that the mainstream media not so much concerned with. Because if they can control it, they can monetize it, they can profit from it, and they can control you. That's the interesting point in all this. It's just amazing stuff. Brought to us by activist judges. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, ricksmithshow.com for now, when you can get it on the web. Also, Stitcher on your smartphone. We'll see you back here tomorrow. Thanks for being here. Appreciate it.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Together, we can make America better. Email Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at TheRickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide of flood beneath the lunar sway. Imperial, mysterious, in amorous raid. Democracy is coming to the USA.